You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So as I said, my name's Martin Bailey. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. Welcome, everybody. I've been sort of praying to the weather gods all week, thinking that we're going to get snow and none of the participants were going to make it from Boston or San Francisco, but everybody's here. unfortunately, they did provide a little rain to dampen the proceedings, but we got a great crowd here, so that obviously has not done too much damage. This is a joint event with the Kellogg School at Northwestern University, a joint project that Ben Harris and I have been running. And I want to acknowledge the financial support we've gotten from the Sloan Foundation and the Arnold Foundation. Could I ask everybody to turn their phones off or turn them to silent? That would help us all. We got a sort of fairly tight program, which means I need to get off the stage quickly, but we haven't programmed in any sort of coffee breaks. So as the people on the stage, if you need to sort of use the facilities which are out the back there or grab another quick cup of coffee, please do that sort of quickly and quietly and return. We haven't put any particular breaks in here. This program will run till about 12:30. The papers are available or will be available on the website. There are some that are out there, hard copies. Certainly they'll be on the website. So there are actually three. The two main ones are the papers being presented, and then Ben and I wrote a kind of framing paper to talk a little bit about the issues. There may be some mild revisions to those, so it's possible that the final versions will take a few days to go up, but they should be available on the website. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce Jim Perturba. Jim is the Matsui Professor at MIT and the President of the National Bureau of Economic Research, one of our most distinguished economists. He's an expert on taxation, fiscal policy, and certainly on retirement. I've dabbled in stuff around retirement in the past, but it was about a year and a half ago I decided I wanted to start a new project on the retirement area, and I cannot tell you how many people said to me, well, you've got to read Jim Perturba's Ely lecture. In fact, it sort of got to the point where, and you know, not only would they tell me that, but they'd say, and he says this, and then he says that. It got to the point where I was sort of like, yeah, I know, the Perturba paper. I read it. But seriously, it's really a terrific paper. It's one that I think if everybody hasn't read, they need to read. But of course, Jim also has a lot of important research in this area. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jim Perturba. He's going to give a speech, and then he and I am going to ask him some questions up on the stage. There'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions. So Jim Perturba, thank you.
All right. Good morning, Martin. Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and thank you, Brookings and Northwestern Kellogg, for hosting this important event. I think my role this morning is frankly to serve as the warm-up band for the really important and exciting presentations by the true experts on the issues around working longer in the U.S. economy. And I think before I start, I just want to acknowledge that this is a really important problem that is never an acute issue that we have to think about, right? At a moment when we're confronting the shutdown and what do we think about the immediate, you know, next couple of weeks, working longer, the challenges of an aging society, these are questions that proceed very, very slowly and very, very gradually in an economy like the U.S., but that doesn't take anything away from their importance. And in some sense, they are really fundamental challenges that we face. And what I'm going to try to do this morning is sort of to introduce the issues around working longer by trying to provide a little bit of a demographic and economic setting for the landscape in which these questions come up, because there are, you know, a range of different policy issues one can think about. But I think the setting, which is that as an economy looking forward for the next couple of decades, we face a really important challenge in terms of the demographic structure of our population, is something that we just want to recognize at the outset. And then that's kind of the big picture, and then the tactics we want to use to address that, I think, are important questions to think about. I want to just say, lest I forget later on, that I come wearing three different hats, MIT and NBER, which Martin mentioned, but I'm also a trustee at TIA, which is a provider of retirement security products and retirement advice and annuities, and I just want to recognize that, because I hope that I can still look at this with unconflicted eyes, but I don't want anyone to say, gee, you know, he didn't tell us about that before he started. So, okay, let me start by talking about two interrelated issues, what I will call the macroeconomic concerns that lead to thinking about working longer and the microeconomic concerns, and they in some sense are different issues. The macro starts from the fact that we are fortunate to live at a time when life expectancy has been increasing substantially in countries like the United States. Maybe someone can move this a little bit so that the grid lines don't quite cut through the numbers. But what I've just shown you here is life expectancy at age 65, kind of a traditional retirement age for men and for women, starting in 1960 and running out to projections that SSA makes for 2060. Okay? And what you find is that in that century, right, life expectancy for men rises by about 8 years. And life expectancy at age 65 for women, which started out higher, rises by something less, about 6 years. Okay, so all else equal, that means that we'll have more older people in the population. And if retirement ages stay where they are, we're going to end up with a larger set of retirees who are not working relative to the size of the workforce, okay, if nothing else changed. And you can see we're about halfway through this transition along the way. And one important thing that I will note now and say more about in a few minutes is this is not an equally distributed improvement in mortality across the income distribution. And that's something that's worth thinking about as we come back. Okay? So what this would map into is something like a larger share of the over 65 population. And you can see that by looking at a measure which is the old age dependency ratio. And this is just the fraction of the population, 65 plus over the 25 to 64. And there are various different measures of dependency ratios. The other alternative is to add in children plus the elderly and divide them by the prime age population. There's an old Swedish adage that I heard from George Akerlof that says, one woman can take care of seven children, but seven children can't take care of one mother. That somehow the way societies and families handle child care versus elder care can sometimes be different. So I have focused here on the older part of the dependency ratio, thinking about that because it's particularly relevant for our discussion today. What you see is that in 1960, there was basically one member of the 65-plus population for every five people who were in the 25 to 64 group. Projecting that forward, it rises by a factor of 2.5 to 2060, right? And we haven't gone too far down that path just yet. Right, we're now in the mid-20s in those numbers. And, of course, the aging of the baby boomers and the entry of the baby boomers into retirement is going to ramp this number up quickly. This increase is not just due to the increase in life expectancy in old age. Okay? It's also due to the fact that fertility rates have fallen, which means that there's a double whammy. Right? As people reach 65, they're reaching there with more years yet to live, and there are smaller cohorts coming up behind. So we're moving through a transitional period where even if life expectancy hadn't changed, a decline in fertility would have meant a larger old age population relative to the younger population. The two forces together mean that we are in a period of really historic transformation of the demographic structure of the U.S. population. And this raises what I will call the macroeconomic question, which is how does one manage to provide for an older population with a smaller group of workers relative to retirees? Okay? And one answer to that question is, well, perhaps you encourage people to work longer. And just to set this in some perspective, right, if instead of doing the ratio 65 plus to 25 to 64, you'd looked in 2060 at the ratio of 70 plus to 25 to 69, right, assuming that people worked for five more years, that 48% number would turn out to be around 32%. Right? So it would take you to a higher level than we are today, but you would see a much more gradual increase in terms of the change. Right? Now, I'm not immediately suggesting that a five-year increase in work life is on the agenda, but I think it's important to understand for the macroeconomics here where this fits in. Okay, the second issue is the microeconomic aspect of this working longer. Okay, and this focuses in the here and now, and it talks about the adequacy of retirement security and retirement preparation of U.S. households approaching retirement. Okay, and here, heterogeneity is going to be the watchword, and I'll say a little bit more in a minute about, you know, the status of the population, but there are certainly concerns that some significant part of the U.S. population, particularly the baby boomers, are not very well prepared for retirement. And this has to do with the shifting nature of retirement security provisions, the shift away from defined benefit plans to defined contribution, and I'll focus for a minute on the low level of returns that people might expect to earn these days relative to in the past, which I think is a very important challenge. Taken together, this means that there may be a group of people, okay, maybe half the population, maybe somewhat less, that is not especially well prepared to sustain their living standard in retirement. Well, what do you do about that? Facing a longer lifespan after retirement, one way to build up more retirement assets is to work longer. And that gives you, in some sense, a double benefit because, as later speakers will explain, by working longer, you shrink the retirement span. Okay. There is a tantalizing possibility out there with some research that suggests that perhaps working longer may actually be a little lifespan enhancing for some people, but I'm going to leave that to the side. But if you just think your lifespan is what it is, working longer is going to shrink your retirement period, and it's also going to ramp up the number of years you have to work, which means you can contribute more and save more in preparation for retirement. So that's the sense in which working longer can be protective of your retirement security at the individual level. So that for that group which may not be adequately prepared, the working longer becomes a very important possibility. Now, very important question to think about. Not everybody can work longer. Right? This is a place where, frankly, you know, calling on the academic community to assess the prospects of working longer is, with no offense to the organizers, distinctly the wrong thing to recognize. Right? I mean, you have to remember in the employment world I live in, the challenge everybody wants to work lots longer. The challenge is to get my colleagues to retire when they get into their mid-70s, not to see if we can encourage them to work longer. Right? So we may not be the right group to be drawing on to understand this issue, but we do have to recognize that there is heterogeneity in the population in who can and desires to work longer, and that needs to filter into our thinking about the possibilities of using working longer as a retirement security device. But for those who can and want to work longer, the notion that one might work longer as a way of providing for one's retirement seems to be a very powerful device because it has this two-edged aspect that is particularly attractive. I do want to flag one thing in recognizing this, and it's quite different. It's a capital markets issue, not a labor market issue, and it's the declining rate of return that's available to savers today versus what their predecessors had. Basically, when returns are low, saving is not as powerful because of the reduced impact of compounding at low rates of return versus high rates of return. And this is, you know, for anyone who's on an investment, who talks to an investment committee of an endowment or a pension fund, this is a real challenge going forward. I'll just show you one simple chart. This is the real interest rate, the 30-year TIPS yield over the last 20 years, basically. TIPS bonds were yielding about 3.5% at the turn of the millennium. They are today yielding something on the order of 1%. And essentially, being in a world where the interest rate's 1 versus 3 or 3.5 is dramatically different if you're a long-term saver. So one of the things that it implies, and I've done some calculations, I'll just kind of roughly summarize for you. If you asked, and behind this simple chart, there's a lot of machinery, which is the assumption that you're saving every year while you work, you're building up a corpus of assets, and then you're annuitizing it when you get to retirement. But to summarize it all, if you asked, how much would I have to save every year in order to replace 50% of my final earnings, assuming my earnings are pretty much flat over my life cycle, with an annuity stream, if I'm saving for 40 years, right? In a 3% return world, I can do that by saving about 11% of my salary each year, Okay, that is actually within the realm of possibility for many households, I suspect. You reduce the rate of return to 1%, and you have to be saving 23% of your salary. That's pretty high. Okay, you reduce the working life to 30 years instead of 40 years over which you're saving. That number jumps to 30%. And I think that's really getting up there in terms of what you can do. Right? So I just want to flag this because I think that the issues that we are talking about today, even if the demography had not changed, even if the birth rate had not changed, even if people had looked like they were well prepared for retirement 15 years ago, the decline in rates of return that the younger generations face in terms of accumulation would make the issue of working longer important. Okay, we need to be thinking about this, but that's not part of the usual dialogue on these topics. All right, so I think that's important to think about. All right, so let me now come back to, you know, if you asked your grandparents, what would you do if you discovered you were going to live longer when you were older? No fancy economic analysis, right? But what would you do? I think you'd get answers very much like what the standard life cycle model tells you to do if you discover you're going to live longer, right? You might say, well, you know, I'm 65. I've just discovered I'm going to live longer. I guess I'll have to consume a bit less while I'm retired. I'll have to ramp down my consumption, right? And that is certainly one reaction to a longer lifespan. Of course, that translates into, in the language of today's discussion, less retirement security, less retirement preparedness, and presumably, you know, lower well-being on the part of the elderly population, okay? If you learned about this earlier, I told you at age 45 you were going to live an extra 5 years when you were retired. You can, of course, increase your saving while working, and that's all got to do with the tilt of your consumption profile and when you're going to do your saving. You could work longer, and, of course, that's where we are today in terms of talking about the changing the retirement period versus the saving period. You could do something, if we were doing this in the context of a financial markets conference, we'd be talking about reaching for yield. Maybe you'd take, you know, you'd invest in emerging market securities instead of in treasury bonds and hope that you were going to earn more. And that's certainly something that we observe in some parts of the financial sector where these kind of long-dated liabilities, like a retirement liability, are on the balance sheet and you're trying to figure out how do you fund them. And then finally, I've put here in very broad terms, collect transfers from working cohorts. And that, of course, could mean if you're an individual, you might think that your children in some way or another might provide for you, right? We go back to before Social Security in the 1930s, right? U.S. household structure looked very different than it does today. The elderly tend to live with their children, right? There were implicit transfers that were taking place within households. One of the first things that happened after Social Security provided more retirement security was the household structure split apart. And whether that was the kids didn't want the parents or the parents didn't want the kids, we don't exactly know. But we know that they decided that they preferred to live independently at that point. And, of course, this can be done at the family level or it can be done at the social level. And at the society level, it's the notion of using intergenerational transfers through something like a social security system that you would think about. And precisely the reason that we're convening this discussion, of course, is because if this is taking place within the fiscal structure and we're using something like intergenerational transfers within social security to provide for the retirement security of the elderly, you marry that insight with what I showed you at the beginning about changing demographic structure, and you then realize that it becomes much more financially burdensome on the younger cohorts to provide for the same level of transfers in a society that looks like the U.S. in 2060 than in one that looks like the U.S. in 1960. Right? And therefore asking, are there some levers we can pull which might involve changing work lives in some cases becomes a very natural question to think about. All right, so once I've shown you the patterns of this demography and rates of return, the natural question is, well, you know, what have households been doing? Do we see any kind of changes? And this is a chart which shows you, it's taken from some of the work at the Center for Retirement Research, that shows you the age at which the labor force participation rate hits 50% in the U.S. population. The gray line is men. You see that it was a little bit over 65 in 1962. It fell gradually into the low 60s, about 62, by the late 1980s. And it has risen since then. It's now about 63.9. For women, the trend is generally up, although that reflects a combination of factors which have a lot to do with women's labor force participation earlier in the life cycle and not just the women's labor force participation activities in retirement. So there's a little bit of an increase, but certainly nothing like a five-year increase in the age of retirement, matching some of the numbers we've seen in the demographics. A more striking chart is this one that shows the labor force participation rate of men and women in their late 60s. Right? Now, these are numbers which are below 50%, so that's how they marry with the previous chart. But what you just see is, you know, when I remember first thinking about the economics of retirement, it was in the part where that men's labor force participation rate was dropping sharply, right? It was when we were down to under 25% and that had dropped by almost 20 percentage points in the previous two decades. Many forecasts at that point said this was just going to continue, and we were not going to see much labor force activity of older workers in the U.S. economy. And then this changed around, right? And it ramped back up. And I know, just to give you a family version of this story, my dad was fortunate to live to 97 and a half. He retired at 62, and I remember describing to my son that Grandpa has been retired for over 30 years, and he looked back at me incredulously and said, "No way." Well, my dad retired near the bottom of this when it was not at all uncommon for people to be doing that. And, of course, my son is thinking about extrapolating this red line out for a few more decades and thinking about what this might look like in the future. So I think this chart is actually very important because it sets up the possibility that there are, in fact, there is the possibility of adjustment on this margin. The labor supply at older ages is not immutable and can be influenced by a number of factors, and we'll, of course, talk about some of them today. So I think at this point, I want to begin to ask, you know, how do we think about the capacity of older workers to work? And of course, there's an enormous volume of research on this topic. I'll show you a little bit of work which emerged from a major research project that David Wise, my NBER colleague, in this case, Courtney Coyle and Kevin Milligan have done. And they've done the following interesting calculation. Okay, we know that mortality rates at older ages have fallen on an age-specific basis, right? So that the likelihood, the mortality rate for a 63-year-old in 2010, for example, is significantly lower than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, right? So do the following thought experiment. Ask the question, look at the employment rate for a 63-year-old in 2010, okay? And this is looking for men, and that number was about 54%, okay? Ask the question, in 1977, for people who had the same mortality rate as a 2010 63-year-old did, what was the labor market activity rate for those workers? Okay? And this is using the mortality rate as kind of a summary statistic to say, how capable were you of working, or what was your ability to work? It's a summary measure of physical health and willingness to work and whatever. The answer to that question is, you know, this is a period where we're looking back, 33 years, and at the same mortality rate, the employment rate was about 82%, right? So a difference of 18 percentage points in the employment rate. And what you see is that for people, men in their 50s and early 60s, the general pattern was about an 18% gap in the employment activity, conditional on mortality rate. You move to older ages, right? And part of what's happened here is since the mortality rates in the late 60s have declined significantly, you find that gap is even larger, on the order of 40%. And I put this up because I think it motivates the concept that many people have embraced, which is there's at least some capacity for additional work at older ages, and exactly how much, hard to know. Many people could critique this methodology, but it kind of gets you thinking about what's the possibility here in doing this. So in the last couple of minutes, I just want to say, heterogeneity is the critical element when we start to think about this, right? Everything I've done so far talks about life expectancy as a single number, mortality rates as a single number at these different ages. But there is a lot of heterogeneity in the health status, the financial status, and the policy status of older individuals in the U.S. economy. And I think that is a really important consideration to keep in mind in thinking about the capacity of working longer to address retirement security issues. So, for example, a thing that we should be focusing on is, are the folks who need more retirement security, right? Think back to my micro motivation, are they the folks who can work longer? Right? Or is there a disconnect between these two groups in a way that's not going to make this a powerful tool for the micro problems I discussed? The macro issues are quite different, right? The macro issues are just, can we generate more output? Can we manage to produce more resources in the economy and consequently reduce the burden on the younger population? And there, even if the population that can work longer is relatively financially well off, right, it may be attractive to provide, you know, increased incentives for labor supply there. But I think that policy design in this area needs to recognize the sort of heterogeneity in a very important way. So let me show you just a couple of things that illustrate this heterogeneity. The first is health status. This is just some data on the number of chronic conditions that people have in advanced age. And what we're looking at is, you know, the first row is zero. So what you find is that at age 65 to 69, about a quarter of the male population has no chronic health condition to speak of, right? These are self-reported, but, you know, you get a sense. Another 20% is basically in the one condition category. Only about 15% have four or more chronic conditions. So, you know, I'm hardly a doctor to speak about this, but that's kind of getting into a population where you might think there are some issues around trying to work a lot longer. You run that forward into the early 70s, and you see that the group with the zeros and ones are starting to melt away. The group with multiple conditions is rising. By the time you're at 75 to 79, we've basically flipped, and the group that has four or more is now looking the size of the group that had zero when we were at 65. But just recognizing that there's variation here is important. Okay, this is manifest in, link back to my discussion of life expectancy at the beginning. Okay. The differences in life expectancy by income status or something like that in the U.S. population in the last few decades are striking. Okay? This is a chart taken from a National Academies report that Peter Orszag, a friend of many people here, co-chaired a couple of years ago. It looks basically at the change, and these are projections, so this is not actual historical data, but it's a projection of mortality improvements. It's life expectancy at age 50 for men. In the 1930 cohort, birth cohort, these are the green folks. So, you know, these are folks who basically today would be in their late 80s, okay? And the 1960 cohort, right? So these are folks who today would be in their late 50s. And it's looking at life expectancy at age 50 for these different groups ranked by lifetime income quintile. Okay? On the far left, you see that there is very little change for the bottom 40% of the population. And there is dramatic change for the top 20% of the population. And top 40% of the population is pretty good. So we're seeing changes on the order of 7 to 8 years of life expectancy at age 50 for the top 40% and, you know, numbers like 1 year at the bottom. Why is that important? Well, it suggests if the mortality rates are indicative of health status in various ways and capacity to work potentially, it suggests that there may be less expansion of that at the lower strata than there is at the top. Okay, now, some very interesting work at the Center for Retirement Research actually looked at this question a couple of years ago and concluded that even for the bottom groups, there was probably some expansion of life expectancy and some improvement in health status. But a lot of this action is basically at the top end. Okay, so that's got to feature somehow in what we're thinking about in designing these policies and asking how this is all going to work. That also matters for thinking about the net lifetime benefits of various social programs, particularly Social Security and Medicare, if you compare the taxes versus the transfers in these programs. But this is a very important feature, I think, to recognize as we think about it. Okay, what about the financial side? Okay, let me show you a couple of slides that just indicate what the heterogeneity in finance looks like for people coming into their older ages. This is data that Steve Venti at Dartmouth and David Wise and I have put together. It looks at the Health and Retirement Study, a very important research tool funded by the National Institute of Aging. These are people who are 65 to 69 households in 2014. Okay? And I want you to look, for example, at the middle column, which is non-retirement financial wealth. And this is always a number that absolutely stuns me, right? This is money outside your IRAs, your 401ks. You know, it's the bank balance, it's your mutual funds, it's whatever else you're holding. The median household in this age group has $12,000 in that category, right? So one very important takeaway is that there are lots of households in the U.S., even on the eve of retirement or early years of retirement, with very little non-retirement, non-housing financial assets to speak of, right? So that's telling you something about the potential resilience of these households to financial shocks and whatnot. You then work your way up, and, you know, at the 90th percentile, that number is a sort of $330,000, but the bottom, you know, is basically zero. Next column over is IRAs and defined contribution pension plans, right? And what you see there is that, again, at the median, this is very low. Okay, it's $29,000, and the median's just about where these plans start to kick in on a household basis. Top end, $225,000 for the 75th percentile, $705,000 for the 90th percentile. There is a group at the top for whom these defined contribution plans have offered them the opportunity to build significant wealth for retirement. But there's a lot of folks at the bottom, either because they didn't participate when offered, or more likely they were never offered plans, who did not use this system in a way which is built very much in the way of financial assets. Social Security wealth, which is over on the far left here, shows you, of course, the much more even distribution across the society, which is showing you that, and this is a crude attempt to think about the present discounted value of Social Security wealth for these households. The median is about $226,000. Top end is about twice that. But when you put all this together, and notice, by the way, defined benefit plans are that second column over, again, they are tilted toward the top end when you look. Net worth for a median household is around $600,000. Net worth at the 90th percentile is a number like $2.2 million. So the spread here is very large. I want to contrast this with what we saw a minute ago on health status and life expectancy, right? A key issue is, what's the correlation between these two pieces, right? If the folks who have the capacity to work longer are in the bottom couple of rows, then the challenge, of course, is going to be, can we use this as a device to help them? Let me offer you a little bit of evidence on that point. This is data taken from the 2016 Survey of Consumer Finances. It shows you the financial assets of those who are near retirement. This is 60 to 64, 65 to 69, of those who are still working and those who are not. Okay. Now, I'm not going to surprise anybody by telling you that those who are still working are by and large in better financial straits than those who are not, right? So the working 60 to 64-year-old households have financial assets at the median of about $200,000. The ones who are not working at all, 34. Okay. Similarly, up and down the distribution, what you see. So, the challenge here is going to be to figure out how one thinks about putting together the financial status and the work capacity in a way which is helpful going forward. I'll close with one thought, no more slides. If you look across countries, there is substantial heterogeneity in life, in work rates at older ages, right? Age 60 to 64, particularly, even age 65 to 69. There's much less variation in health status and other things, which leads me to conclude that the policy environment matters for work life length. It matters for labor supply at older ages. And I think it's a great motivation for what we're going to hear over the course of the morning, which is thinking about how different policy tools might be used to alter the incentives, to alter the work environment, and potentially to change what the labor force participation rates look like at these older ages. So thank you very much, and I look forward to talking with Martin about some of these. Yeah.
I'm getting to an age where my cognitive ability is sort of declining. Operating microphones is a difficult task. So let me ask you a broad question, first of all. You've described a picture where, for some segment of the population, retirement is sort of, they've got plenty of money, they're working longer already, things are pretty good. But for a good segment of the population, certainly the median and below, things look pretty tough. And we also know that defined benefit plans, the traditional pensions, which, it wasn't that everybody had them, but a lot of people, about half the people had them. Those are gradually disappearing, at least in the private sector. So do we have a crisis that we need to make really quite substantial changes in either policy or how people behave? Or is this something where, everything is sort of okay, but we just need to tweak things a little bit? Would you say we have a retirement crisis?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a somewhat unsatisfying answer, which is to say It's complicated, right? Because I think there are actually three different groups that I would try to distinguish in all of this. There's the group that, under the defined contribution system that we operate with today, you know, that top, maybe it's 25%, has actually accumulated a fair amount of resources, and as they enter the retirement years, will be able to draw down those balances. That group also, even in the private sector, has been much more likely to be covered by a defined benefit plan. So they are probably reasonably well prepared for their retirement years. Okay, so that's kind of a top group. And I'm thinking about the kind of calculation that the, you know, the National Retirement Readiness Index that the Center for Retirement Research prepares, or other attempts to use some replacement rate type measure of what these folks look like. Okay, there's a second group at the lower end, and this is, again, maybe a quarter of the population, maybe a little bit more, for whom the progressivity of Social Security means that their replacement rate, while, you know, not fabulous, is pretty good, right? And this, you know, there's a broader societal discussion to have about what we want the bottom quarter of our society to look like. But unfortunately, you know, this is a population that has not earned a lot in many cases as they've made their way through the labor market over their career, and for whom the workings of Social Security and other transfer programs will put them in a position that's not dramatically different from where they were when they were working. So, you know, whether that's a retirement issue or that's just a social redistribution issue, I think is hard. Then there's this middle group, and it's actually the middle group where I think the challenges are greatest. And the, you know, the halcyon days of defined benefit plans in the private sector were not quite as good as the retrospective somehow makes them seem, right? There were lots of folks who did not have coverage, and the nature of these plans meant that some people reached retirement without coverage. But there was certainly a significant group that did. The move away from defined benefit plans, which were expensive for employers but did give a generous benefit to retirees in many cases, and the replacement of those with 401k-type structures where it relies a lot more on individuals doing their own contributing, doing their own investing, right? There's surely a part of that population which has not managed to put enough away to be able to prepare for retirement. And that's the group that I think is going to be challenged. That hopefully is a group that may have the capacity to use some of the working longer device as a way of trying to improve their retirement security. And I think we are in a period where, while I alluded at the beginning to the fact that these demographic changes are, you know, they're kind of glacial, they move through slowly, but we're actually in a period where there's a bit of an inflection coming through, because as the baby boomers are moving into retirement, even between the older boomers and the younger boomers, there are differences in the extent to which they worked under the defined benefit system in the private sector. So as DB plans were kind of ramping down in the 1980s into the early 90s, or workers who were joining jobs were finding they were not covered by DB plans any longer, that's changed the nature of what the retirement arrangements for these folks will be. So we may be seeing people who are turning 65 in 2025 or 2030 looking quite different in this regard than those who turned 65 in 2015.
So let me ask you about the group that's sort of maybe the bottom third or below the median. So Social Security becomes extremely important, as you said, for that group. Now, one of the contributions that John Chauvin and his colleagues have made at Stanford is assessing the fact that if you work longer and you wait before collecting Social Security, you get a significantly higher Social Security benefit from that. And that really sort of changes quite a bit how much benefit that group will have as they retire. But that's the group that's sort of been waiting tables for 30 years or humping boxes for a package delivery service. And we're sort of saying to them, hey, you've got to work another 5 or 10 years and wait until you can collect Social Security. Moreover, you know, Social Security is not in the greatest shape after all. And you pointed out that the dependency ratio is going to go up a lot. People are talking about the need to cut entitlements, but, you know, with rising dependency rate, that's going to be tough. So this adds to my sense that there is a bit of a crisis there, because the people that are dependent on Social Security, it's a struggle for them to get past the point of collecting at 62 and putting it off till 65 or 67 or 70. and the status of the program. So does that need a sort of emergency surgery as well in terms of the Social Security?
I think it's a great question. I think it's important to distinguish two different things as we think about the Social Security claim. Okay.
This is complexity. I was not
sure. Right. I think in thinking about the Social Security claiming age issue, it's important to distinguish two things. Right. One is working longer as a way to defer your Social Security claim date, and the other is waiting to claim because you have other assets that enable you to defer that decision, right? And here, you know, I think there's a nice complementarity between, say, the DC system and the issues around Social Security. So it's important to remember, right, that work is negative leisure. If you go back to your Econ 101, right, there was a labor leisure choice. You worked, you took leisure. Leisure was a good. Right, and working longer means you're giving up the leisure. So I don't think anybody listening to this discussion today should be lost on you that if we're thinking about people working longer, and that's basically hard, they're giving up the benefits of leisure that they otherwise would have had. Okay, that's a distinct question from if you have money squirreled away in your 401k or your IRA, and you're thinking about your work life has stopped at age 65, should you claim Social Security benefits at 65, or should you defer given the way in which your Social Security benefits will be recalculated? And of course, the work that John and his co-authors have done, shows you.
Sure, I should say it.
Yes. I mean, all our panelists have done very important calculations of how to think about the rate of return that someone earns by deferring their Social Security. I think the key question is, if we're thinking about working longer as opposed to claiming later, right, then what part of the population can work longer? Now, this is where, you know, I think that some of the work that Alicia and her collaborators have done shows that the fraction of jobs which involve the kind of, construction, bricklaying, things like that in the U.S. economy is declining. So while I don't think anyone should ignore the fact there's a group that really probably is, you know, they're either borderline disabled or they're facing real limitations on work by the time they get to age 60, age 62, we need to be thinking about how to protect and help that group as they get to this age. But there may be a substantial group for whom the capacity to work longer is greater. And I think for that group, right, the key is to kind of remove the rocks from the road, to not have there be, artificial disincentives to work or incentives which pull them out of the labor force when they might, in fact, be quite comfortable working longer and contributing and, of course, you know, addressing my macro challenge, which is what's the societal output that enables you to basically sustain this retirement group. But I think I call it heterogeneity. You may call it are folks beaten down by their work lives. I think it's a really important aspect of thinking about this, and we have to move below the top line, you know, what is the life expectancy, into a more nuanced, what is the fraction of the population that is able to basically continue in the labor force to older ages?
We're sort of running out of time, but I want to give the audience a chance. So there's a question over there. Please state who you are and ask a question and don't make a speech. Thank you.
Hold on a second.
Wait for the mic.
And push the green light.
You're better than me.
Okay. I'm not colorblind, by the way, so in my old age. But, Jim, I'm Ted Knutson. I'm a Forbes contributor. The conventional wisdom is that the difference between those who can work longer and those who can't is basically white collar, blue collar. Is conventional wisdom right?
To be honest, I'm not an expert on the labor market data here, but I think to a first approximation, it's the kind of manual job, which is more, I mean, there's not a lot of manual white-collar stuff out there. The question is, are there some blue-collar jobs which are not particularly physically demanding and where you could, in fact, continue on, or where there may be opportunities to do something that is perhaps not the initial lifetime job but gives you a way to continue with some labor market activity? I think one of the things that my labor economics colleagues have demonstrated over the years is that retirement is not as discrete an event as the simple stylized economics model would suggest. It's not you hit age 63 and then you're done. But in many cases, it's a second job. It's a part-time job, particularly when you do this at the household level with, you know, an average age differential between the husband and the wife of about 3 years of those reaching retirement age today. You know, it may be that one spouse is retired, the other is still working. So there's a number of ways that households can actually continue to have labor income as they look into these advanced ages, which are relative to think about. But I think, you know, your rough dichotomy of white blue collar is probably not a terrible way to start down this path. Yeah.
Okay. I think we only have one more question at the back there. Yes.
My name is Elizabeth White, and I'm the author of 55 Underemployed and Faking Normal. And a couple of weeks ago, ProPublica and Urban Institute, there was a study that they did that showed over half of 50-year-olds workers are pushed out of the job market in their 50s, and that those that get a job, again, only 10% get a job that's commensurate with the job that they left. So there's an element I'm hearing of choice to work when I think it actually may not be there.
You know, I think that question in many ways tees up a really important broad issue, which is how do we do lifetime education, skill retraining? You know, as you think about a career which might last 40 or 45 years, the notion that the existing model, which in many cases we operate with, which is acquire some skills at the beginning of your career and then use them for the remaining length of your career, right, doesn't quite feel like it's the way to operate, right? And I'm not the right person to tell you whether the clock speed with which technological change and labor market change is taking place has gone up, but I kind of have a sense it has. You know, that all puts an emphasis, I think, on trying to find ways to facilitate retraining, skill acquisition for workers who are in their 50s or maybe their early 60s. That may be a very important part of thinking about how do you succeed by enabling workers to stay in the labor force longer. And I think we are just at the beginning of asking those questions. The kind of data that you're, you know, describing, I think, I've certainly seen statistics along the lines of what you are characterizing. And you know, whether that is the result of sectoral changes, you know, the decline of some parts of the U.S. manufacturing base and things like that, with these workers no longer being employed with jobs they previously had, which might have been a transitional event in the U.S. economy, or whether this is a generic part of what the life cycle experience looks like, which would, of course, suggest we need to work much more hard, much more attentively to this, I think it's very important to think about as part of this discussion. Yeah.
I'd like you to thank Jim Perturba for, I'm struggling here, Jim Perturba for his fantastic speech and his answer the questions. We have a great session coming up with Bob Clark and John Chauvin, so stick around. Thank you. Thank you, Jim.
Ready?
So good morning. Thanks to Ben and Martin for putting this program together. John and I have been writing various papers on these kinds of topics for quite some time, and we tried to focus on the issue that we were requested to do, and that was, are there ways to think about providing increased incentives for older workers to remain in the labor force? And somebody took the clicker. What I can do here. So I just want to start with some premises that Jim laid out to begin with. Oh, he's going to fess up and
no.
So Jim has already laid out a lot of information on this, but what we know is that the population is aging, that the ratio of retirees to workers is rising, and that creates a variety of problems both at the individual and at the national level.
People are living longer, so for individuals as they approach retirement, there's a longer period to provide for. No matter how you calculate it, you need more money to have the same level of income in retirement years if you're going to live longer. People are healthy in general, and as Jim has said, heterogeneity across all of these issues is a big issue.
Is there a problem with a microphone?
So they have, yeah, so they've wired me up, and they have that one as well. I don't know the answer. That one's supposed to be off, they told me. I think we're right. Okay. So basically, Jim has covered most of these points. And so as we think about the...
You have to stay near the mic.
They told me this one was off, and I've got one right here that's supposed to work. It's not working. It is now. I got the... Yeah, I found the clicker. The clicker has appeared. Okay. So, again, topics that Jim has covered, and this bottom line is one that he hammered home. It's one that we've talked about, and most of us here have talked about in a lot of different ways. If you need more money per year to have the same amount of income per more money, wealth accumulation, to have the same income per year into retirement, you got to start with a bigger stock. And there are various ways that you can have that bigger stock, either through personal savings or other types of activities. And so we were sort of asked to think about this issue from the following standpoint. What are the impediments to people continuing to work? And as we think about impediments, we look at the programs that can provide substantial disincentives to work. And that includes the Social Security system and some of the characteristics that we're going to talk about. It also would include Medicare and how that's been changed over time. And so what we're thinking about here is that for most of the people 65 and over, payroll taxes are pure tax. They're not really getting anything extra for continued work and continual tax payments. And if you are faced with a tax, higher tax, these put all those things together, depending on how you think of the incidence of the employer tax, you're talking about approximately 15% lower income per year because you're paying these taxes and getting nothing for it going forward. So we're looking at this as a standpoint of what can we do, what proposals can we make that would increase the incentive for older people to stay in the labor force. To start that, we rejected the idea that one way to keep people in the labor force is to cut their benefits and have them lower income, and so they have to work more to have the same level of income at that point. So we're rejecting that, and so we're trying to think about what can we propose that would reduce these disincentives to work embedded in the current systems? Okay, so we're going to make three particular proposals. One is the complete elimination of the earnings test. I'm hopeful everybody in this room will agree. That would be a big hope, but perhaps we can reach that level. Propose to have a paid-up status for Social Security and a paid-up status for Medicare, plus a return to Medicare being the primary payer for medical benefits for everybody over age 65, which is what it was for the first part of the history of Medicare. So the outline of the presentation, I'm going to give you a brief description of these proposals, talk a little bit more about the earnings test and the others, and then John is going to come in and work through our estimates associated with the impact of these programs. Our main point that you can start to consider now is that we want you to think about the cost of these programs and the advantages of these programs in a more holistic setting that is consider not just Social Security, but also consider the general budget of the federal government. So we may have higher Social Security costs, but we may get a savings because people are working more and they're paying more taxes, and that ought to be considered, not just looking at just the Social Security aspect of this. Proposal number one, complete elimination of the earnings test. If you go back and look through the history, there are lots of papers on the Social Security website under Steve Goss's office there about how this program has changed over time. And basically, if you look at historically, you know, when it was first started, it was 100% tax on all earnings. And the clear implication was we want to get people out of the labor force. So you put this tax on. It was a different time, different demographics, different economics. And so you had a system that was explicitly trying to get people out of the labor force. We think that's wrong today. And over time, what's happened is older beneficiaries have been excluded from the earnings tax. The thresholds have been changed. The level of the taxation has been changed. So there's a long history of reducing the impact of this program. And we're arguing that why not go ahead and completely eliminate it? There are some facts that most of you know. Earnings test, 50% on earnings above a certain limit applies only to those people below the full retirement age. We all know that the full retirement age is rising over time. So the question is, how does that impact the decision of people to work? And of course, this means, do people understand what the earnings test is and how it results in future changes in benefits? It's our belief, and of course, many of you have friends, or some of us are already in that ages, where you might have hit the earnings test, and do you really know what happens when your benefit goes down? Yes, you can see that. Do you really know that there's a future recalculation of benefits? Yes, it's true, but maybe you don't understand that. And as a result, there's a lot of confusion about what this tax is. And I'm sure we all have stories. I once had a piece of property in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and we put a little trailer up there, and we dug a well, and I needed a guy to come over and put the electricity up. And Condiff Nestor came over out of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and he was very happy to help me. And when I said, can I pay you? He said, no, I'm on Social Security. I'll just lose it. So he did it for nothing, which was nice of Condiff. So if we look at these things in this way, people are thinking, we believe, to a large extent, that this really is just a tax, but it results in future benefits. And so, in general, labor supply of older workers, we're going to mention this a number of times, we think it's fairly elastic, which means a higher income from working leads to more work. And this is a theme that we will come back to throughout the program. So the question is, does this earnings test save the Social Security system money? And Steve Goss has done a number of estimates of this. And in fact, according to Steve Goss, right here in the front of the room, when you put the tax, if you were to take the earnings test off, it increases the cost in the short term by a little bit, but it increases the cost in a few years by even more. And so over the 75-year period, there's actually a cost saving to the elimination of the earnings test. Not a lot, but a little. So basically, here's a plan that confuses people, doesn't bring any income, probably reduces labor supply of older people. Why do we keep this program? And so our proposal is just that the complete elimination of the earnings test. So that's proposal number one. Everybody agree with that? Let's see the hands. Come on, fess up. God, it's not 100%. I don't get this. Okay, so proposal number two is the paid-up status for Social Security. So, again, people are working throughout their career. Right now, they continue to work, and every extra year, quarter, paycheck, they pay more payroll tax. After you get to a certain age, or 35 years and a little bit more, there's no extra gain in future benefits, or if it is, it's really small. Yet, so every paycheck, you're still paying 6.2% of your pay, and your employer is paying 6.2% of your pay for a program that doesn't add any to your future Social Security benefit. So the question is, what would happen if we eliminated that payroll tax for people at a particular age or years of service? And we're not wedded to a particular program here. In the paper, we talk about eliminating it at the full retirement age, which is going to be 67, and who knows, with another change or two, it might go up. But right now, I'd say you get to 67, almost everybody's got going forward will have little impact on their future benefits by paying this tax. So if they reached a paid-up status, that would mean they don't pay the payroll tax, and their employer doesn't pay payroll tax. You could say you'd rather have a certain number of years of service, 45, 80 quarters. And again, Steve has an estimate on his website that says if you do 45 years, 180 quarters, you're free. What's the impact of that? And there is a small, some people might argue large, but some people would say small, impact on the cost of the long-term cost of the program, looking just narrowly at Social Security. So we believe that if we increase, impose this paid-up status, people would get somewhere between a 6.2 and a 12.4% raise, and that would lead them to work more. If they work more, their earnings go up, they pay income tax, and that extra income tax should be considered into the cost and advantage of the program. And so we're proposing, and John is going to give you some numbers here in a bit on that. Our other proposal is that we would introduce a paid-up status for Medicare, and in addition to that, return Medicare to a primary payer status. And this would mean, again, people would not pay the payroll tax. And if Medicare is the primary payer, that means that an employer doesn't have to pay for health insurance for those people that are in the paid-up status. So if you think about who bears the burden of employer contributions for employee benefits, a lot of people would say it's the employee in the form of lower wages. If you put that together with the two payroll taxes, John's going to tell you how big that number is and how much we think it will affect the overall cost of the program. So we want a bit of an evaluation of these programs. John is going to come up now and tell us about the paid-up status of the two programs. We're just acting as if you all are agreeing with us on the earnings test.
Yeah, now somebody make this mic work.
It should be.
It should be. Well, I've been known to have a big mouth, so maybe we'll be okay. In evaluating our proposals, we believe that these proposals would raise the net wage that workers, older workers, would earn, and that because of that, they would work more, and they'd have higher income, but the IRS would also have additional revenues, and we want to take into account the IRS revenues in addition to the costs that would be incurred by Social Security and Medicare. By the way, state income tax revenues would also go up. We do not take those into account. We now will estimate some of these things. Before we do, though, there aren't a lot of studies about the labor supply elasticity of older workers. There are a few, and those that are available suggest that older workers have much higher labor supply elasticities than prime-age workers, and I'll show you what those are. We're going to evaluate our proposals with elasticities of 2 and 3, and I'll show you that the key references are Eric French, who was at Chicago when he did this. He's now at University College London, and Hudamet Hurd and Rowader, who has a very recent paper on this. So let me show you what French says are the elasticities at different ages. And notice at age 40, it's a pretty low elasticity. People are going to work at 40. If you tax them or don't tax them, they're going to work. But at age 65, the elasticity is 11 times higher. It's pretty elastic. And that's where we're reducing the taxes and getting the response. By the way, optimal tax theory would say that you want to tax the inelastic factors and not tax heavily the elastic factors. That's what we're doing. So I just pointed out that these are the results of Eric French, and 11 times is the factor. And they're consistent with a very recent paper by Hurd and Rowader and co-author, which simply asked people, do you think you'd be working at 70? And they give an answer. And he said, well, what if I told you that your wages would be 20% higher at 70 than they are now? would you be working? And they calculate elasticity that way, and they get results consistent with this. Now here is just the evaluation of the paid-up proposal, but paid-up for both Social Security and Medicare. And today, if you earned 100 bucks, the third number on the first column, it cost your employer $107.65 because they have to pay the payroll tax. You have to pay a payroll tax. And if you're in a 12% bracket, you have to pay that as well. So you only bring home $80.35 out of the 100 you just earned. Under the paid up, you would earn not 100 but $107.65. We think that the employee is bearing both halves of the payroll tax. You would actually pay a little more tax, but your take-home pay would not be 80 bucks, but almost 95 for about an 18% increase. If you were in a higher income tax bracket, and in today's law, most middle and low-income people are either in a 12% bracket or a 22% bracket. We evaluate both, and notice that by just going paid up, your take-home pay goes from $70 to $84. So that's almost a 20% increase, and so 18 to 19% increase simply by having the paid-up status on both Social Security and Medicare. So that should bring some response. But now let's go to our Proposal 3. Our Proposal 3 is also to make Medicare the primary payer instead of the secondary payer. What that means is, the current law is if you're over 65 and you work for an employer with more than 20 employees, then your primary payer is your employer-provided plan. It's not Medicare. That's not how it was before 83, but that's how it is today. If you don't work, you get Medicare. If you do work, you don't get Medicare. That's a big tax. Let's go to that plan. So we estimate that about 20% of payroll for older workers is the value of the Medicare that they're not getting or the value of the health insurance that the employer is providing. So now if you earn 100 bucks, the first column, it's costing the employer $127.65. 20 bucks for the health care, $7.65 for the payroll tax. You're still bringing home 80 bucks. If you went to our plan 3, you'd have almost a 40% increase. Your 80 bucks would go to 112. If you were in a higher bracket, your 70 bucks goes to almost 100 bucks. These are about 40% increases in pay. And if you combine that with Eric French's elasticities, you're going to get quite a significant response. So take-home pay would go up by roughly 40% under our plan 3 of paid up plus changing Medicare status. Now let's go to an evaluation of how much this is going to cost. So consider the current workers over 65, and how much is that going to cost Medicare and Social Security? Well, we think per $100 of their earnings, it's going to cost those two programs $35.30. Where do we get $35.30? Well, $15.30 is the payroll tax that they're no longer collecting. 20 bucks is the Medicare that they're not paying now, but they would under our plan. So for existing workers with existing hours over 65, it would cost $35.30. That doesn't depend on elasticities. That doesn't depend on tax rates. That's why these 35-30s are there. Now, if you go to our programs, your wage goes up quite a bit, and so you pay more taxes. So that's the numbers that start with 332, 608, and so forth. You pay more taxes on the existing hours. Now, say new people start working over 65, or existing workers work more hours. What does that cost the program, Social Security or Medicare? The answer is nothing. workers who are not currently working aren't paying Social Security taxes, and when they start working, they're not paying Social Security taxes, so that's nothing. Workers that are receiving, people that are receiving Medicare who start to work, they're still receiving Medicare, no change. So there's no change in cost for the extra work. Well, how much, here's the pay raises, the 39s and the 41s. Those are the pay raises that would result. This is the extra income that Eric French's numbers, what elasticity of 2 or elasticity of 3 infer. Notice that this is per $100 of current earnings. There'd be another $100 of earnings if the elasticity is 2, and another 150 some odd dollars if the elasticity is 3. Now, why is this existing 100 bucks gets another 100 bucks? That sounds like an elasticity that's pretty, is double for only a 40% increase. How come? Well, because these new hours are not being paid. They're getting like a 35% raise because they're getting more. Even if the hours go up by 80%, the income goes up by 100%. Okay? So then we just applied the taxes that the people would get, would pay, for this extra, and we get the net cost. Notice these net numbers down here. They're low compared to $35.20. That $35.30, if the elasticity is 2 and the tax rate's 12, 22, $6 per $100 of current earnings. About 1/6 of the sort of static cost is the dynamic cost. What if you go to elasticity of 3? The $35, actually the government gets actually 41 extra dollars, more than pays for itself. Now, we're not saying that these programs pay for themselves. We're saying under some elasticities they would. But we're saying that these would cost the government a lot less than they would cost Social Security and Medicare, a lot less under any scenario. This bottom row numbers are the cost per existing 100 bucks, $9, $6, $13, minus $6, versus the $35 that the programs are paying. So if the IRS shares its IRS pocket is getting stuffed, and if they shared that back with the programs, these policies would not be nearly as costly as the static numbers would lead you to believe. So we think in the case of the 22% tax bracket, the offset is between 83% and 116%. So a major, major deal. So I'm going to conclude. I think it's consistent with what Jim said. I think, and what Martin said, I will agree with Martin, or I will say I think there is a retirement crisis. And I think the retirement crisis is that we're trying to do the impossible. And the impossible thing we're trying to do is finance 30-year retirements with 40-year careers. If you take that 62 and 64-year-old median retirement age, say you were a couple, a 64-year-old and a 62-year-old, and you retire, and you want to know how long until the second to die for that couple. Chances of the second to die living 30 more years is about 40%. 40%. So you have to be financially prepared to live 30 years, but you've only worked about 40 years at stage. So I think we're trying to do the impossible, and that creates a problem. That creates a problem for the states, the local governments, the employers, the Social Security, everybody. 401k savers, DB plans, they're all, that's a hard thing to do. And so I think we just have to change the division of adult life between work and retirement. And we can't do it for everybody. We have to figure out all about the heterogeneity that Jim talked about. But we have three ideas that we think are a good starting point. Eliminate the earnings test, have a paid-up status, and put Medicare back to where it was originally designed as the primary payer for people 65 and over. And we think it's a good start. And that's all I got.
not going to steal this.
Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fancy pointer, did it work?
Oh, you're all very patient. You just sit there. It's great. So I'm delighted to be here. I'm Alicia Minnell. I'd like to thank Martin and Ben and Brookings and Kellogg for putting on this conference. I must say that Abby and I are a little jealous of Bob and John because they had a well-defined problem. They could go calculate disincentives to work and precise programs and come out with precise solutions. We're dealing with mushier stuff. And the good news or the bad news is that Abby and I have spent the past year and a half dealing with mushier stuff. So in some ways, we're the right guys for the job. So first of all, why are we here? This is, I'm going to go quickly because everybody has said the same thing. This, we're going to, the reason we have to think about working longer is that if things go on the way they are, today's working households are not going to be able to maintain their standard of living in retirement. If other people have said, working longer is a powerful tool to combat that. If you claim your benefits at 70 instead of 62, they're at least 76% higher. It gives some time for your when you have 401k assets for them to grow. And then this is the most wonderful thing. If you start at 22, retire at 62, you work for 40 years, but you have to support yourself for 20 years, that's 2-to-1. If you switch over 8 years and put those in the work side, you change that whole ratio to 4-to-1. So it makes life look much easier. People are working longer. The problem is they're not working long enough to keep the retirement span steady. So something has to be done. And our assignment was to look for stuff outside of Social Security and Medicare that would encourage people to do it. So we're experienced at doing that because in Massachusetts, the governor had a council to address aging in Massachusetts. And I was a member and Abby participated. And I was not only the member, but I had the honor to be the chair of the work and saving subcommittee. And I participated in the housing, which we could talk about some other time. And the goal of the work and saving subcommittee was to have people save more and work longer, and how do you do that? And so on the save side, it was pretty easy. We said, let's have an auto IRA program for Massachusetts. On the work side, you don't have a lot of tools, and it was a bit harder. The thing we did have is we have one of the most popular governors in the United States, a Republican governor. And so everything we thought about was really in terms of his participation in this effort. And so on the employee side, we thought the governor could go out and say, people off Massachusetts, you need to work longer. And people would believe him. On the employer side, he needed to say to the employers, there's a strong business case for hiring older workers, and people would believe him. So when you go to the national level, new options open up. You have more than sort of just the bully pulpit. And so the way this our remarks are organized is that we have what can you do to encourage the employee, what can you do to encourage the employer, we have sort of incentives, and then this education stuff. And I have never been a great fan of education stuff, but when you don't have any other tools, I go for education. So in the real incentive world, the most logical thing to look at is the earned income tax credit. Now, the earned income tax credit was introduced for low-income families with children. It wasn't until 1993 they even thought of having a credit for people who had no children. And even then, they limited, the whole program is limited to people 25 to 64. So there's the benefit is only $500 for maximum benefit for a childless person compared to $3,500 for a a family with one child. Now, people on all both sides of the aisle have recognized that this is inadequate, and there are lots of proposals for expanding it. You can see, though, by this chart, that the expansion proposals are very modest compared to the benefit available to a household with one child. And beyond that, of all the proposals, only one, I think it was by President Obama, extended the age upward, and that was only from 65 to include 65 and 66. So there's not a lot of exciting things that have happened here. So Abby and I, in our wisdom, sitting in Boston, thought that a credit of about $2,000 for older single workers might really help. And extending that age from 65 to 70, we estimated, if there are anybody here from CBO, don't be afraid, your job's secure. We estimated that the cost about $300 billion over 10 years. But it might really help that, because it would raise the wages for the people that we really care about. Bob and John are raising my compensation, which I think is wonderful as a rich person, but this would go to the other end of the scale. Then the next thing was clarify the benefits of working longer through a three-part campaign, and that these parts consist, three-part campaign, and those are three things: create a social norm of 70 as the retirement age in the United States. That does not mean increase the full retirement age to 70, which I think is an inequitable across-the-board benefit cut, which is not what I'm talking about. But change the conversation that, so that what we used to think of as 65 is now 70, to sort of fight against this notion of wealth illusions. People think they look at a big pile and they go, oh, my God, that's so much money, I don't need to work any longer. And then the third issue. So let's start with the first one, which is anchoring is important. This chart may not be immediately obvious to you, but what it is, it's from a study of the Netherlands that sort of said, whenever they said it started at 65 is the base, and then you lose money if you retire early or gain money if you retire later. Everybody said they were going to retire at 65. If they started with 67 as the beginning of the discussion, then everybody retires at 67. So anchoring is important. In the United States, 65 used to be our anchor, but it's really disappeared. It was a very important age for defined benefit plans, but defined benefit plans in the private sector are rapidly disappearing. We used to have a mandatory retirement age at 65, but that has disappeared. And government retirement ages are all over the place, 62 for early retirement under Social Security, 65 for Medicare, 66 and 6 months for the full retirement age, and age 70 for the age at which you get your highest benefit. So who knows what we're doing? So we think that 70 should be the national retirement age. And that means that people in this room and politicians and everybody has to go out and say 70 is our national retirement age. It's the age at which you get your highest benefit from Social Security. It's the age, interestingly, that keeps the ratio of working retirement years to working years constant over time, which is sort of like what it was in the 1940s. And it makes very clear to people that if you're retiring before 70, you're doing something early and you're going to lose stuff. And so I think it will change the conversation, but it requires people, respected people, to shout it from the rooftops. But I think it's worth the effort. We did a little exercise a few years ago with the National Retirement Risk Index to say, you know, at what age would your target and your projected replacement rate be equal? And what it shows is that if people retire till work to age 70, 85% of people would be fine and not at risk. This brings up the heterogeneity issue. Of course, not everybody can do it. This is disability-free life expectancy at 50. Clearly, there's some people who can't do this, but I don't think that should be an argument for not telling everybody else to do it, and then let's help the people who can't do it. So that's the first issue, educational issue. The second one is sort of money illusion or wealth illusion. So you look at your piggy bank, it's got $100,000 in it. And actually, that's about what the typical household age 55 to 64 approaching retirement has in combined 401k IRA assets. And so they go, my God, who's ever seen $100,000 before? And so that people feel rich and they feel like they can retire because they've got plenty of money. So the important thing, I think, to drive home is that you can have $100,000, but when you're really looking at what that provides in monthly income, that's not very much. And so we think, or we support other people's efforts to get 401k balances reported in terms of income as well as piles of assets. There's been the Department of Labor has been pioneering in this. I think provisions like this are included in RESA and other legislation on the Hill. And I think it would make a difference. Third, provide materials to educate workers on the benefits of working longer. So here is what Abby and I have been doing for the past year and a half. Because what do? I mean, you've got a task force, a subgroup, a work group. You have to do something. So we have an elevator speech. So if you are ever caught with somebody and you need to explain quickly why they need to work longer, I will give this to you. Then we have, sorry about this, we have PowerPoint that we think that employers can have seminars and saying, so you think you want to retire. The good news, you have a long life ahead. The bad news is you don't have enough money to spend, to support yourself. So this is our work. We take some pride in it, but we think that a professional could probably do even a better job on this. And so this is our second piece of material. Our third piece thing is an older pamphlet that we did for Social Security on the claiming age. And it sort of goes into all the issues. And I've always liked this. I think Social Security liked it, but they found it a little zany for their culture. And so, but I think it could be part of this packages that we're handing out. So these are three strategies to get the word out. We need everybody to get the word out. We were thinking Massachusetts, so again, we had our governor. We haven't actually asked the governor to do this, but we plan his life. And so we expect the governor we hope the governor would go out and actually talk about these issues, help get people interested in employers interested in educating their workers and moving the debate forward. Okay, so that's our stuff on the employee side. Now on the employer side, just take a deep breath and you'll be calmer about the next point. So our proposal here is to restore mandatory retirement. And so we realize that's a little bit controversial. But I think it might be helpful to both employees and employers, because we all know that employees have a hard time, older employees have a hard time finding a new job. And I know employers don't like people with gray hair. And so I think part of the fear is that if you hire somebody in their late 50s, that they're going to stay with you. They're not going to have enough money in their 401k, and they're going to stay. And so if there was some age limit that we could agree on, it might really help both sides. And so our notion, Abby actually isn't mad for this, so don't take it out on her. But we thought that 70 would be a default mandatory age. And if you, as the employer, didn't want to participate, the employer could opt out. If the employer didn't opt out, then the employer would have to notify the employee 6 months before, saying that 70 is the mandatory retirement age. The employee would have some right to petition to stay, and the employer would have to do responsible things. So I actually think it might be helpful. The other issue is to make the business case for older workers. And there's a lot of stuff around that people have. But it's all things like Stella has been with the bakery for 40 years. People love it when they come in and see Stella behind the counter. And so that's good, but it doesn't seem totally persuasive to us. So we actually wrote something called the business case for older workers. And there wasn't anything else out there. If there was, I would have taken that. But when you actually look at it, lots of change. In the old days, older workers used to be a lot different than younger workers. But increasingly, older workers look very much like younger workers. They're just about as healthy. They are just about as well educated. They all have iPhones and iPads and computers. They make less severe errors. It's not like they don't make errors, but when they do, they don't kill the patient. And they are more likely to stay with you over the next 2 years. And so there's a strong, really strong case. I've lost my pamphlet because we also had only not only this, but we had thank you, Jim. We had a colorful pamphlet that, again, we need a professional that we you could hand out to people. But again, this requires the governor to call in the business leaders in Massachusetts, sit down with 10 of them, saying, I've read this, I think this makes a strong case, I think your benefit business would be better with older workers. And then they will go out and spread the word to 10 other business leaders. And that's actually what you could, you know, basically all you can do. It could do it at sort of a more national level by getting the Department of Labor sort of involved as partners in some states and see, and then do some assessments, or we could do the assessment, of seeing whether that type of activity improves the employment status of older workers. Okay, so there are two things on our list that people might talk about in this sphere, which we did not talk about. Because the first one is pretty easy. Increased job training for older workers. Yeah. This is how interested the United States is in doing that. We just don't do it. And so it seemed like it was just sort of whistling in the wind or spinning in the wind or in the wind. And you can see that the United States is dead last. And then Abby found this wonderful chart from GAO of the stuff that we do, only 11% has been evaluated. So that just seemed like a non-starter for us. You can say the words, but I don't think it's going to happen. The second is a little more controversial, which is phased retirement. I hate the idea of phased retirement. It seems like a diversion from this notion of working longer. Of course, economists think if you expand the choice set for individuals, they're better off. But it really hurts the attractiveness of older workers if you say, hire these people and they need all this special time because they have to go to the cardiologist on Thursdays and they have grandchildren and they'd like to take them to Florida for spring vacation and they'd like to kind of phase out over time. And like, who would hire them? And Abby worked with the, going back to our council, with the caregivers group. You cannot imagine what this group wanted for older workers. extensive, I mean, sort of respite care at work. I mean, just millions of things. So I want people to hire. I want older workers to look attractive. I think they're good. I think people will be happier to have them. And if you have this whole list of special needs that they have, I worry that they're going to put be less attractive. And also, we did some study that people's happiness about retirement depends on whether they make the decision to retire or not, not whether they retire fast or slow. But most importantly, and this is one of the worst charts we've ever had in our repertoire, you won't be able to understand it no matter how long you work. So this is from Gussman and Steinmeier, two guys who did a structural model. And they sort of said, let's say you allow for phased retirement. What do you get? Well, there were some people who were going to working full-time and wanted to slow down, but they didn't have the option, so they retired. You give them phased retirement, and they're going to work more hours. But there were other guys that were working full-time that were going to work full-time for several more years. You give them phased retirement, and now they're working less. And so they added up the pluses and the minuses, and they found no increase in hours from phased retirement. So those are the two issues that we sort of ignored. So I just want to get a good summary here. So I think I'm more of an evangelist than maybe not more than John, but I really do think that this is a key component to, not the only component, not the only thing that has to be done, but working longer is one of the most powerful things that can be done to solve the crisis in retirement. And policymakers can encourage individuals to work longer by improving the earned income tax credit, changing the culture and talking about 70 as our retirement age, requiring 401k plans to require income as well as assets, and providing educational materials for workers. Policymakers can encourage employers to hire and retain older workers by restoring mandatory retirement and making a clear and compelling case, economic case, for the value of older workers. I think that we don't need much more research in this area. I think we know the answer. We just have to go ahead and implement it. Thank you very much.
Steve, yeah.
And Bob and Abby. So let me just get started with a few comments while our panelists are coming up here. Alicia, that's the first time I think I've heard an economist say we don't need more research on this. That's novel. Let me just start with a word of thanks. So on behalf of the Kellogg School of Management, I'd like to thank Martin Bailey and Brookings for being such generous partners in this, and Anna Dawson, everyone else for help putting on this event. Let me just say, I mean, as someone who has studied retirement for about 20 years now, I'm a little awestruck. This is a great group. I mean, we've got Alicia, we've got John Chauvin, Bob Clark, you've got Seth and Steve and Abby. This is a great group. So I'm really excited about this event. And Jim Peterba giving a keynote. You know, it doesn't get any better than this. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Let me just start with really quick introductions. Everyone has the bios in the event materials, so I'll be brief. To my left, we've got Seth Harris, so no relation. People sometimes make that mistake. But so Seth was the acting Labor Secretary and Deputy Labor Secretary under President Obama. He is currently a visiting professor at the Cornell Institute for Public Affairs, in addition to a practicing lawyer. Then we have Steve Goss. Steve is the Chief Actuary at the Social Security Administration, where he has served since 2001 as the Chief Actuary and longer with SSA. Then we have Abigail Walters. Abby is a research associate at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. And then finally, we have Bob Clark. Bob is a professor in the Department of Economics at North Carolina State University and also an NBER research associate. So we're going to give Seth and then Steve a few minutes to react to this. and then we'll hear from the authors, we'll have a discussion, and then we'll open it up for questions. So let's just start with you, Seth. What do you think?
Well, first of all, good morning, everybody. And let me start by, am I on? Can you hear me? Okay. I want to start by congratulating Martin and Ben, not merely on today's event, but on the larger retirement security project that they're working on. I'm firmly convinced, I side with those who say we are in a retirement crisis, a retirement savings crisis, as well as a retirement income crisis. So the search for answers, putting them into policy form that then is translatable into actual policy, I think is really, really important. So let me start with Bob and John's paper. And the paper, as you heard, offers three proposals, and I agree with 2.5 of them. That's going to be a continuing theme throughout my comments. Let me start by adopting and agreeing with a methodological choice they made, which is to look at costs and benefits beyond just the trust funds and to look at income tax and welfare costs and other things. To me, that's the right methodological choice. We shouldn't let budget structures interfere with making good policy decisions, and it's certainly consistent with the concept of a unified budget. Okay, so on to the proposals. The elimination of the earnings test during the specified period to me seems like an obviously correct choice. I was surprised that every hand in the room didn't go up. Read the paper. With the deferral of the reduced benefits to later years, the earnings test, I think, comes off as something like a pure behavioral device to get people to do the exact opposite of what we need them to do in a retirement crisis, which is to work longer. So to me, eliminating that makes all the sense in the world. I also agree with the paid-up status for Social Security, and I'm going to disagree, though, with one economic assumption the authors used in their analysis. Let me just say it's very dangerous when a lawyer commits an act of economics, but here I go. I do not agree that employees pay 100% of of any costs that are paid by an employer nominally, like payroll taxes or benefits costs. To me, that's an economic assumption drawn from theory, not drawn from a labor market where you've got lots and lots and lots of transaction costs, you have information failures, you have asymmetrical information, you have variations in workers' bargaining power. My friend Alan Krueger puts the number not at 100%, but at 80%, and I think even that is a little bit too aggressive. Nonetheless, with respect to the Social Security paid-up proposal, the authors assure us that even if you don't take the 100% assumption as being true, you still end up with essentially a revenue-neutral outcome. So if you can increase older workers' labor supply and therefore increase their earnings and you don't have a significant budget impact, I'm in. That, to me, was also a pretty easy one. And I felt the same way about the Medicare paid-up proposal for much the same reasons. Here's where my skepticism kicks in. I am skeptical about Medicare as the principal payor for employees of who are participating in employer-provided health insurance plans. There's no question that that proposal would save money for employer plan sponsors and maybe their insurance companies, but I don't think those savings would be passed along to older workers in the form of higher wages, and therefore it would not increase the supply of labor in the way that the authors hope that it, or think that it will, or have analyzed that it will. And here are my three reasons for coming to that conclusion. One is my point before: I don't think employees pay 100% of the cost of the employer insurance premiums for health or anything else. So reducing the premiums doesn't trigger 100% pass through to the workers. Second, I don't think workers have the necessary bargaining power to wrest the money from employers. A good illustration of that point is employers saved a mint with the shift from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans. I've seen no evidence that employees have shared in that in those savings at all. In fact, I think the opposite is quite true. Let me also say you can point to the Trump tax cut and the promise that workers would get $4,000 apiece on average. That didn't happen either. It ended up going to stock buybacks. And the third point is that the authors talk about their base case being based on an assumption that employees pay for both ends of the health insurance premiums and that therefore reduces their wages below marginal productivity. In workplaces where you have an internal labor market, I don't think that's how it works. Now, not all workplaces are internal labor markets. This building is an internal labor market, but many other employers are not. And in internal labor market theory, in their older years, workers are being paid above their marginal productivity because they were paid less in their training years early in their career. So I think it's worth taking another look at that half of the proposal, but thank you for putting it out there. Let me talk about the Alicia and Abby's polyglot paper, which I thought was terrific. Again, I'm not going to be able to discuss, because of the short time, I'm not going to be able to discuss everything, but I want to highlight 2.5 proposals of theirs that I agree with and a half that I have some questions about. I completely agree with the idea of expanding EITC eligibility and making EITC more generous. It works. It works to increase people's labor supply in the populations that are currently served. Let's try it on some new populations. We know it works. Let's try it more broadly. Second, I also completely agree that every retirement saver should receive an income illustration based on their retirement savings. There is a lot of evidence that retirement savers don't understand how much money they are going to need in retirement in order to be able to support their lifestyles. Alicia referred to that in her presentation in chief. But everyone who has worked knows what income looks like because they're used to getting a paycheck. I mean, they've seen that. They understand it. So if you illustrate how much income Americans will get on a monthly basis or on an annual basis, they will understand better how much money they need to save for retirement. And by the way, there is evidence that it shows that it changes savings behavior among particularly older workers, but other workers as well. Let me also say the value of those illustrations is that it will encourage discussions about not only retirement savings, but retirement income and how retirement savers can generate income that's protected and will last for the rest of their lives, including products like annuities, which are the only ones who provide truly protected lifetime income, apart from DB pensions and Social Security. Third, I like the idea. I'm with Alicia. I'm a skeptic about financial literacy training and education programs more generally, but I actually like the idea of employers engaging their workers in a discussion about working longer, not only because it puts employers on the hook a little bit, but also because it will encourage a discussion about how to maximize Social Security benefits, and it will be hopefully part of a larger retirement planning discussion, which I think employers can play a really constructive role in inspiring. I share the view that unlike a lot of financial literacy training, that kind of advice can really change behavior, because I think workers understand what working longer looks like. I think it's easy for them to relate to. I'm a lot more skeptical about government making a business case to employers about who they should and shouldn't employ. I have a little bit of experience with this from my time in the Labor Department with respect to workers with disabilities. I just don't see a lot of evidence that employers think that government can persuade them to behave differently, or that government knows something that they don't know about who they should employ. I just don't think it works. I think employers are, they'll sit there and nod their heads, they'll join a committee, they'll take a lovely brochure, they'd love to hear an academic talk about it, and then they go back and do exactly what they were going to do. Anyway, I just don't think that that's especially persuasive to folks. So that's my reaction to, so the score, the final score is 5 yes, 1 skeptical.
Thank you.
Okay.
Steve.
Can I go up there for my slides?
Sure. Yeah.
Like Seth and all of us, I want to, you know, really thank Martin and Ben for, you know, putting this together, and also for the opportunity to come and react a little bit to some of this. And of course, I have to say, you know, being a current federal employee, that anything I'm saying here does not represent SSA or the administration or anything like that. Just sort of some personal comments. And I guess what I really want to, this is plus goes to.
Right. Oh, it's a different one.
Flip it over.
Oh, okay. Just, there we go. Got to go to the computer. So there was no pre-planning. I did not see Jim's slides before here. I don't think he saw the couple of slides. And by the way, Ben said I could have one or two slides, so I said, fine, three. That's one or two. Okay. So add them together. So the first slide that you want to show you is exactly, we're sort of, you know, coming back on the circle here. One of the first things Jim was talking about was the age of dependency ratio. We define it a little bit differently. We say, hey, you know, you can start working at 20. So we have 20 to 64 in the denominator and 65 and older, sort of the classic age of dependency ratio, a pure demographic look at what's happening with our population. And I guess what I'd like to suggest here is really that what we're talking about here is that this really does define, as I think Jim very well described, what our retirement challenges. Call it a crisis if you want, but it's a challenge. We're going to have to make adjustments to make sure that we're going to have enough savings, enough work, enough money for people in retirement, wherever that starts. And one of the things here, and Jim also alluded to this idea that there's both the issue of people living longer, but also the changing age distribution of our population. That's what this is all about. It's the age distribution. And you can see, had the baby boom generation total fertility rates stayed at where they were, at like 3.3 kids per woman on average, or even been at about 3 instead of dropping down to about 2, our age dependency ratio would look like those blue and pink lines. And we wouldn't really be talking about a crisis or anything like the kind of challenge we have now. The real thing here, the big level shift that's happening over the next 20 years in this age of dependency ratio, why we have this enormous challenge now, is because of the drop in the fertility rate. It's the classic, you know, we used to have 3 kids working in the population for every retired couple, and now we're going to have 2 kids in the working population for every retired couple. That just changes the dynamic dramatically, and that's what we're sort of facing on to the future. And I would suggest also, this is so important, I think Jim also alluded to this and others, that this isn't just Social Security and Medicare, the pay-as-you-go systems. I mean, I would contend we live in a pay-as-you-go world. I mean, thinking about it, you've got all this wonderful, you know, money that you've saved up. You maybe not just tips, maybe you've also saved some in equities, which, by the way, might give you a net return on your retirement portfolio more than 1%. I mean, I guess we would hope so. At least most of our advisors tell us that. So, you know, what are you going to get for those monies that you've saved up when you retire? Well, there's supply and demand here. If it turns out there are very relatively few people compared to past generations who are working at the time you retire, who would be the buyers of your security when you want to sell them to live off of them, maybe the value of those securities is not going to be as high as you had hoped or expected. So I think we really have a challenge here. And this does take us to the question of the working longer, or I guess I'd like to sort of maybe just suggest a little bit of an adaptation of that, not that it's really different, but working more. Because it's not just a matter of working longer. If we could go to the second slide here, I would just want to share with you, these are not labor force participation rates. They've been a little bit kind of weird lately because of, you know, measurement stuff perhaps. But this is just looking straight up at number of people employed in the population divided by number of people in the population. And what you see here is, look down at the bottom here, the 70 and over, or the 65 to 69, or the 60 to 64. Not doing too bad. These things are going up. This is like good stuff. And they've been going up for quite a while. They've been going up from a time starting well before 2000. Remember, 2000 is when we eliminated the retirement earnings test above the normal retirement age, which was 65 at the time, and also when we started raising the retirement age for Social Security, which also was thought that should be encouraging. Well, we already had these things trending up before 2000. And they've continued to trend up. That's wonderful. It's not entirely clear that there's a whole lot of extra net work in the economy that we can tell at these ages from these two kinds of approaches. But if we look, so that's great for 60 and over, but look at what's happening for 55 to 9, and 25 to 54. If we want people to be prepared for retirement, yeah, it is one way to do it, to say, hey, just keep working until you drop. And I remember a while back, a guy named Paul Samuelson, when he was once asked by Zvi Bodhi some years ago, what's your retirement plan? He says, it's my human capital. I'm going to work till I drop. Well, not everybody can do that, as has been much discussed. So if we really want people to be prepared, if we want them to be saving up in their 401ks, and by the way, I love the idea that's been kicking around for a while, and hopefully Lucian and Abby are going to sort of push this even more, to actually get people to understand the translation of a lump sum. People are so awed with their lump sum in their 401k and don't understand what that actually translates into. And I would think if we did it on the basis of showing what it would look like as a replacement rate based on your accrued amount of money you have at this point. Don't talk in dollars. People get all kind of flummoxed with dollars. If we could put in a replacement rate based on what you've accrued in your accounts to date, that would help people. And hopefully it would help them to think, I better not start drawing this out early. And maybe I ought to try to put more in. That could really be. So regardless of what the work is, if people are willing to sort of shift their priorities in the younger working ages to put more aside for retirement, that could really help. Not to say that we don't want to see these curves at 60 and over keep going up. And by the way, in our methodology, and I think Jim alluded to this in some of his remarks, in our methodology for projecting labor force participation rates and employment rates into the future, we directly have a built-in notion of what's going to happen to life expectancy at higher ages, just about exactly what Jim was talking about. We look at the life expectancy at a given age and 10, 20 years out. If the, we look for the younger age that would have had a similar life expectancy back in the day, and then we take a portion of the increase in labor force. So our extrapolations of these numbers for the higher ages would be continuing on from what we've got here. But I guess the point I'm really trying to make is we're seeing progress already under our current circumstances. I think our sense has been, because people are living not only longer, but at any given age, they're living healthier than they are now, and the nature of jobs that are available in our economy are allowing people, a lot of them, to work longer than they were, the blue-collar, white-collar kind of issue from before. So at the higher ages, sure, let's encourage more, let's get people working even longer, but I think we'd better pay a lot of attention to what's happening at the younger ages, too, because it's in those periods where people have to be accruing or should be or we hope will be accruing the assets that will allow them to retire whenever they get around to that. So let me go to now my final slide, which is something that is a little bit different. This is now finally I'm getting to something that's really sort of Social Security specific. These are, and Alicia and I have talked for many years now about claiming age. These are these are looking at the percentage of people who are insured to receive a Social Security retirement benefit and aren't already getting a disability benefit or some other kind of benefit only. And the percentage of them at each age, 62 is the blue line, and then moving on up, the percentage that have actually started to receive their benefits at that point. It's sort of a prevalence thing. And you can see what we've got here for the males on the left and the females on the right. We can see that the percentage that are taking their benefit at 62 rose to a peak back, you know, around like 1990, 1995, but it's been dropping ever since. And note, it's been dropping starting before we started to have the retirement earnings test eliminated above NRA, and it started before we started raising the retirement age. So it's just things going on. I think one of the things, and, you know, Gelser was running a lot of others talk about, when the baby boomers were all coming to the population, we were flooding the labor market, so a lot of employers started offering early outs to people up in their 50s and 60s, and that's probably a lot of why we had people, you know, dropping out of the labor market at that point. It's probably maybe sort of the leading cause. But so where are we going with this? Well, we can see on this something really interesting. The retirement earnings test for people at 65 and over, now it's 66 and change and over, by 2022 or so it's going to be 67 and over above our NRA, no more retirement earnings test. Well, all of a sudden we see what happens. We didn't see a dramatic jump in the number of people working from eliminating the earnings test, but what we do see is a jump in claiming or starting benefits. And so what this means is we've got a lot of people starting their benefits earlier than they might have, which means they'll get more reduction in their monthly benefits for the rest of their lives and for the rest of a potential surviving spouse's life. And one thing that I can share with you, I hope this isn't like too much out of class, but back in 2000 when there was enacted the elimination of the earnings test above the so-called normal or full retirement age, there was serious consideration of lowering it to eliminating it above 62. But the principal item that caused that not to happen was a recognition in modeling, not ours, but in a lot of people's modeling, that that would cause people to take the benefits earlier, just exactly as you see here. And it would be even earlier if we would allow people to work as much as you want and get your benefit on top of it at 62. That would cause a lower level of benefit for that worker for the rest of their life and for their surviving spouse. And the modeling indicated that we would have a significant jump in the number of elderly widows who would be in poverty as a result. So again, sure, there might be some extra work as a result of this going on, but what is going to happen in terms of people's actual adequacy of retirement income if it causes them to start their Social Security benefits earlier? So many other things to really, you know, sort of talk about in this. And am I like out of time or past, or I can't read it at that angle? But okay, getting there. Okay, so again, I just want to reiterate the idea of the education aspect of getting people to understand this. I remember I was at a conference with Aspen Institute. A couple of the people in the room, like Frank Tedisco, were there some time ago. And one of the things, there were a bunch of people there from a bunch of mutual funds and insurance companies talking about, we cannot sell a life annuity. We just can't sell a life annuity. We sort of understood people were worried, oh, what if I get run over by a truck tomorrow and all this kind of stuff. But then the thing that sort of dawned on us at a point was, oh, we're the victims of our own success. We've gotten people so enamored with seeing that $100,000 level, that $200,000, whatever. They're so should we be shocked that that we've convinced them it's so important to build that large nest egg and how beautiful that is that they don't want to give it up for buying a life annuity? Especially because we haven't even made a serious effort to try to convince them of the relationship between what annuity would be. And I think Jim, you had the annuity before. Was that even an indexed annuity, or was that a flat dollar annuity? It was a flat dollar annuity. So if you have people want to go out and buy like a CPI or 3% or something, but that indexed annuity, that starting level is going to be even lower than what Jim showed. And we're not telling people about this. And the key on this, I would think, is when people have like at age 40, 45, 50, they have a certain amount in the 401k and they say, wow, I'm feeling so wealthy, I don't even have to save anymore. Or I can start, you know, buying the Lamborghini instead of the Ford now because you know, what the heck? I can go into debt elsewhere because I have these assets to balance it. If people understood what this really meant for their retirement income, maybe it'd make a difference. Now, I don't have, like, any answers about how we could, like, encourage more work in general, but I do have a little bit of concern about the idea of having the paid-up status. And I guess I would ask from the French work and also from Bob and John, you might want to address at some point the business of you're assuming that if we do the paid up, aha, we're going to have more income available to these elders and they might work a little bit more. Would there be any displacement of younger workers? Because I think the way you've got it modeled here is it's 100% extra work. If there's, now you might argue there's not going to be, and I'm not talking about displacement by elasticity of desire to work. I'm talking about elasticity for demand of work. I mean, if an employer sees that they can keep an elder on working longer, and so maybe they don't have to hire as many younger people. If anybody saw SNL this past weekend, they had a little skit up there about the young people all complaining about these boomers just hanging out of the jobs for too long. Now, maybe there's not too much of that, but there is one other aspect of it. If we did have paid up on either Social Security or Medicare, if we're still going to pay out the same amount of Social Security benefits, if we're going to do that, then the elders aren't going to be chipping in their amount. Somebody else is going to have to pay it. And maybe those extra money you're positing that we're going to get from income tax, we can modify that, have that go over to Social Security. But if, in fact, that didn't happen, if we had some other uses for extra income tax, just to think about that for a bit, and Social Security was less money, would that mean we'd have to, well, maybe raise the payroll tax rate for the people who are not over this age? Who are the younger people who on the margin we might think are not saving as much as they should? If we start taxing them more heavily, are they going to have less ability or less desire to save money towards their retirement? So, you know, in the zero-sum game and trying to achieve retirement here, I think there's a lot of things to consider. The final thing on the retirement age, thank you so much, Alicia, for saying that the intent here is not to encourage increasing the normal retirement age as it applies for Social Security. That's not your intent, but... But sometimes we in our office, Karen Gunn and I and others, we've done a lot of work on showing like equivalent retirement ages. We've seen a lot of proposals from a lot of places. And most people, when they talk about raising the retirement age, they really are talking about changing the retirement age to Social Security because we are underfunded now because of that first graph, because of the changing age of dependency ratio. There's got to find a way to either lower the level of scheduled benefits or raise the amount of revenue. Not all that many people excited about raising revenue and getting more taxes. Some yes, some no, and someday the political balance will work out on this. But the idea of lowering benefits is appealing to many, and one way to do it is to continue and to extend the increase in the retirement age. So I just said, you know, when you talk about having a national, and I think in the paper at one point it said full retirement age, that's something a lot of people will hook on to and say, well, we should be doing that. And that's fine. But again, that just lowers the level of the adequacy of the Social Security benefits. Now, it does help in terms of providing enough money to be able to pay for the scheduled benefits. You know, one way to pay for the scheduled benefits, if you don't have enough money coming to pay for your scheduled benefits, well, lower the schedule. And raising the retirement age is one thing that could be done on that. So I understand you're not suggesting that. You're very, very clear. But I think in talking about raising the full retirement age or the normal retirement age, a lot of people will interpret otherwise. So I'm actually just sort of doubling down on your point so that people not misunderstand that. And I guess with that, I probably over time. Okay.
So let's give Bob and Abby a chance to respond to these critiques. Abby, do you want to start? You have any comments?
Sure. So I think on the point that changing employers' behavior is incredibly difficult, and part of the idea with
is it? Who knows? Give it 10.
Okay. So that it is incredibly difficult to change employers' behavior. Part of the idea was that it wasn't necessarily the state being the full front of it with all of its organizations, but really the governor having these meetings and then encouraging these employers to then spread the word. So that really would create a ripple effect, rather it's being seen just as a lecture.
Bob, do you have any reactions to these critiques?
Yeah, a number of things. So first, I think the whole notion of population aging and individual aging, they're two different issues, but they're both very important, and we need to keep that in mind all the time. The theme that's run through all of our discussions is the heterogeneity issue, and that really led us to think about looking for incentives for people to work longer, not disincentives by cutting benefits to push them in that direction, and I think we certainly ought to keep that in mind. Our major point that came up about, what's the real cost? If we believe the estimate that you cited, it was 80% instead of 100% shifting, no big deal. I guess you were trying to argue that it's zero, even though you didn't have support for that. But so just, one,
didn't argue
the assumption there is not really important to the argument that we're making. And one could have a variant of what we propose so that you don't even change the employer tax. It's just the employee tax. But there's also this labor demand stuff that Steve was coming back to. And so even if you don't believe the income is shifted forward, the lower cost should affect the demand for older workers there. And it's certainly an issue. One issue that John and Jim and I have been thinking a lot about is employer concerns for people working longer. So we've got several projects. We've been running some meetings trying to identify those, and those concerns are real. So we've had conversations and surveys with senior HR managers, risk managers, about what is it that they're worried about. And, there's a variety of things. It's the high cost. It's the high employee benefits. It's the productivity issue. All of those are real concerns, and one of the concerns is blocking younger folks coming up. So all of those are real concerns that we have to take into account when we think about these issues. But on balance, encouraging people to work longer by removing disincentives to work, I believe, is a very positive position to take.
So let me just ask you a follow-up question, Bob. So just, let's say you're sitting here, you're talking to a group of workers, and they're saying, look, this is easy. You're calling this from the cheap seats. Like, I'm already working 45, 48 years, and your recommendation is to put in place all these different reforms that mean I have to actually work longer. Like, you're telling me that's going to make me better off? And so in the terms of economics, is this really welfare-enhancing from the perspective of a worker?
Again, you sort of slid over the key assumption I was just making, is it's not we're telling people that they have to work longer. We're not even saying that it's desirable for everybody. We're saying if you decide to work longer, here's an incentive to do that. If you're thinking about at the margin, do I stay working or do I retire, we're making that a more advantageous choice to keep working. But we're in no way saying to everybody you ought to work longer. We're in no way saying, boy, you're not being socially responsible unless you work 50 years instead of 45 or 40 or whatever it is.
Makes a lot of sense. Abby, your center releases this National Retirement Risk Index, which gets a lot of attention, I think both by economists and by the media. Can you talk us through, let's say that your plan is in place, right? And so, we see people working longer. How does this change the share of people who are adequately prepared for retirement?
Sure. So the National Risk Index, what it does is compares people's income as their working age households, and then looks at what their income needs to be in retirement to maintain that level of consumption. And what we see is that if people work towards age 70, over 85% of households would be able to maintain their current standard of living in retirement at age 70.
And so, Seth, you've been a member of a cabinet. Let's say that we go back in time 4 or 5 years ago. President Obama
promised.
President Obama calls you in and he says, "Look, you say you like 5 out of 6 of these proposals. Let's say we put this in place. These address the supply and demand for older workers. Is this the magic bullet? Is this the thing that changes American retirement?"
No, Mr. President, with due respect, I've never found a magic bullet in my life in public policy. Mm-hmm. The retirement crisis is a big, complicated, multifaceted challenge. But I take the premise of this conference to be true, and that is that you can help to address a piece of that problem by addressing the challenge of workers who are leaving the labor market or stopping employment and stopping earnings earlier than maybe smart retirement planning would suggest that they should. Not that they should just sort of in an abstract moral sense, but just because within a sound retirement plan, it just doesn't, the math doesn't end up working out for them. So the reason I like these proposals is because it helps to address that problem. But we have to be honest about what the limits are. I would start sort of where Jim started, and a number of people have come back to this. He used the phrase heterogeneity. There are a lot of people who just are not going to benefit from this proposal. And let me say, with the president we served, would have been very concerned about those people as well. So if you can't work due to disability, either because of the physical demands of the job or availability of jobs in your occupation, if you are transitioning to Social Security from SSDI, from workers' compensation, a lot of people who are on unemployment insurance, older workers who are on unemployment insurance, if you're prematurely retired because your mind or your body or your skills don't happen to match up with the modern employment market, labor market, at least for jobs in your occupation, these proposals probably are not going to help you very much. And that's important not just because we don't want to oversell the effectiveness of the proposals, but because particularly where there are positive costs, and I take Steve's point about the positive costs, you have to make really clear-eyed, cold-hearted assessments about whether or not, one, you're going to get a return on investment when you're spending money, but two, whether we're spending money on the right people. Right? And this is Alicia's point about the EITC, is that you are spending money on the people who need the help most when you dramatically expand eligibility and the generosity of EITC. The second point, and John made this point very passionately, and I share his passion completely on this, the modern retirement system sets up an extraordinarily difficult challenge for the overwhelming majority of workers, which is that we expect you to save a small percentage of your income for 35 or 40 years to fund a very large portion of your income for 25 or 30 or 35 years. And these proposals, where what you're doing is you're just changing the two blocks of time, shortening one and expanding the other, shortening retirement and expanding work, that makes the math better for some folks, particularly folks like Alicia and me who are upper income folks. But for a lot of folks, the math still is not going to work, even if they were to increase the amount that they work and decrease their retirement time. So I'm not a believer in making the perfect the enemy of the good. So if you're going to chip away at part of the problem with solutions like these, and you're not going to take resources away, as the revenue neutral proposals that Bob and John have made, and I think the morally correct proposal that Alicia and Abby have made about EITC would do, then I'm for it. I think we should do it. But when you start spending money and start making, there's opportunity costs to spending that money, and we have to think a little bit more deeply about whether or not that's really the right way to go. That's sort of where I got off the boat with the Medicare primary payer. If I was going to spend Medicare dollars or if I was going to spend health care dollars, I don't think that's where I would spend very limited health care dollars.
And so now let me just turn to Steve. Steve, you commented mostly on the Social Security proposals. If someone came to you and said, look, we want to improve the landscape for older workers, we don't want to touch Social Security, what's your recommendation?
For older workers without touching Social Security, well, I think the one that struck me as being the most important is to try to get people to understand what the value of their now DCs, since DBs are pretty much gone. I mean, we worked with Dallas some years ago on what I lovingly call the X chart, about how DBs were going away and DCs were taking over, and the fact that people don't really understand, and they have the ability to access to a great extent. Even in some DBs now, I think Ford and GM a while back started giving a lump sum option. If we could better, infuse in people the importance of that. But if I might speak also, because Alicia was at least framing it as not being a Social Security issue, trying to put people forth on the idea of looking at as aiming themselves towards a higher age for retirement or planning to stop working. The one thing that I think that we've had quite a bit of discussion about, and Jim certainly was hitting this hard at the beginning, is we're not all the same. I mean, everybody in this room is pretty much the same. We're probably, any blue-collar workers here been doing heavy manual labor lately? Probably not. So, but there's the rest of the world out there that is very, very different from that. And inevitably, I think we all know that we are going to be looking towards increasing, whether it be a mandatory age or whether it be increasing ages for Social Security. One of the things, Social Security's normal retirement age is going up by 2 years. How about the Medicare age? Should that be going up? Would people favor that as well? It would save money for Medicare, which might help counterbalance a proposal to allow people to stop paying in taxes after a while, conceivably. But I guess the one point I would like to make about the inevitable proposals that we have been seeing and will see about raising the normal retirement age for Social Security is it's not really one size fits all. And we do have one really nice example of a proposal we could point to. We've got it up on our website, a little advertising here. This is back in the Simpson-Bowles Commission. The Simpson-Bowles Commission, like many other entities, recommended let's have a gradual ratcheting up of the normal retirement age and maybe even the earliest eligibility age, 62 as well, to keep the sort of ratio of potential retirement years to potential working years about the same. And it would basically insulate the cost of the program from increasing longevity. It doesn't insulate it from changing in fertility rate and the age distribution, but at least would insulate it from that aspect of it. And there was concern by some on that commission of, because it's not one size fits all, what can we do? And they said, can we start having different retirement ages for people in different occupations? Unfortunately, our data sets don't really allow us to say, you know, if Seth and I are both working for Ryder Truck and he's in the front office and I'm out there changing these monster tires on these trucks, very different kind of work, even though our EINs were from the same place. So they said, how about if we focus it on people who are long career and low earnings levels and cut them a break? And I think the deal was if your average earnings throughout your career are less than 2.5 times the poverty level, we won't raise your retirement age at all. If it's 4 times or higher, then we'll raise it by the prescription and then have a sliding scale in between. So I think there are ways to sort of address this. And again, I need to double down. I know that Alicia is not recommending this, but given the financial status of Social Security, especially if we were to start exempting more people from paying the taxes, we're going to have a challenge. And retirement age recognition of increasing longevity is almost certainly something we're going to be seeing.
So let me ask another question, and Bob, maybe you can take this, anyone else can jump in. One thing we didn't hear about at all today, we heard about a lot of different struggles that older workers face. We didn't hear about the role of caregiving. And so there was recently a paper, Steve and I were both discussing this at APAM, paper by Barbara Tricia and Nadia Kramcheva from Urban and CBO, and they showed a really high incidence of spousal caregiving for people in their 60s and 70s. When you're 50s, there's some taking care of older parents. By the time you get to your 60s and 70s, I was shocked by the amount of spousal caregiving. How does this play into this whole discussion?
A very broad question, outside of my main area, but certainly the fact that if people are going to spend more time in the home taking care of spouses, and that's historically has been primary role of the wife as opposed to the husband, that leaves less time to work on the outside. So to the extent that people do need care, they have to pay for it in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. One way of paying for it is lower earnings of the spouse, but also then you can buy it on the market. That requires even more money than you have, and those prices are pretty high for quality care.
Makes sense. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, I also think that paid family leave and the Family Medical Leave Act are really important when we talk about caregiving, because it gives people job protection if they're having to take their spouse to doctor's appointments. And then also California has set up a paid family leave program, and there's been a paper that shows that nursing home admissions has actually declined. So I think paid family leave also provides benefits to folks as well and for the state.
I just add one piece to that. That's an extraordinarily important point. I would add in the, shall we say, very serious challenges of the long-term care industry. Mm-hmm. Have put even more burden on family caregiving as opposed to third-party caregiving and even institutional caregiving. And until the LTCI market gets sorted out, if it ever does get sorted out, the burden is going to remain very heavy on families to provide that. They are the long-term care for the large percentage of Americans right now.
You just commented. It is fascinating, the paid leave kind of concept here. It seems to have a lot of traction on, shall we say, sort of both sides of the aisle. One of the distinctions, though, seems to be, and sorry to be talking about the cost and the paying for it kind of consideration here, how do you pay for it? And California, and I think there's a Senate bill that's been around for a little while, that would suggest having it done by like a little payroll tax or a payroll tax to help fund this and to finance this, then as people need the benefits, they get it. There's also a bill by another senator that we worked on and scored recently, which would pay for family leave in a little bit different way. For every month of family leave that you take, you end up having your normal or early eligibility age for Social Security elevated for you by 2 months for every 1 month of paid family leave that you get. So, you know, bottom line is good things are good because they cost money, and so we got to figure out how to pay for them.
Seth, let me ask you a question, and then anyone else should feel free to jump in. So you've written and talked a lot about the role of the gig economy. Is this good news or bad news for those of us who think that people should be working longer? Is this an opportunity for older workers, or is this a hindrance?
Yeah, so I think the best answer is that it's really a mixed bag. So when we talk about the gig economy, the phrase that I try to use is the online platform economy. So we're talking about Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, Thumbtack, all of these platforms that I see some people on their phones right now probably getting their Ubers ready to go. Right, that's what we're talking about when we talk about the online platform economy. So what's good about it from the worker's perspective is that the worker gets to decide when, where, how long, whether they're going to work, which is quite different from a traditional employment relationship. So for older workers who want flexibility but also want to make extra earnings, there are some opportunities created by these online platforms. But I think the effects or the opportunities are really going to be quite limited. And let me give you a few reasons. One is it's still quite a small percentage of the American workforce. It gets written about a lot because journalists drive around in Ubers. But it's according to the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, it's about 1.6% of the American workforce, and that includes all of the platforms, not merely the personal services companies that I just listed off, but also Etsy and Airbnb. That's everybody. Now, the rate of growth is really substantial, and the number of platforms is proliferating. But still, it's quite small. It might get to be really important, although we're seeing sort of a higher birth rate than death rate, but we're still seeing a death rate among those companies. Second, older workers tend to be underrepresented in that part of the labor force. So the numbers that I have is that this is, again, J.P. Morgan Chase, 1%, it's 1.6 for all workers, it's 1% for workers 55 to 64, it's 0.5% for workers 65 plus. So the stories we all hear about people my age or older driving around millennials after they've gotten drunk at a night partying, that's really the exception rather than the rule, I think, in the gig economy. And the third thing is most people work for the online platform economy only a few months out of the year. They don't do it full year. It accounts for maybe, again, J.P. Morgan Chase, about 20% of their income throughout the course of the year, more in the month in which they're working, which suggests that what they're doing is they're smoothing other income. They're not really relying on it as the principal source of their income. The last point that I'd make about it is most of those workers, or many of those workers, I don't think we know an exact number, are independent contractors rather than employees. And as a consequence of that, they don't get minimum wage protection, they don't get overtime protection, they don't get unemployment insurance, they don't get workers' compensation, and most importantly, they don't get included in an employer's retirement plan, which, as we know, dramatically increases. If you are in a workplace where you have a plan available to you, it dramatically increases the likelihood that you will enroll in the plan and start saving for retirement. These workers are largely excluded from that. Some of the platform companies are trying to work on solving that through various ways, but they still have not solved it. So a lot of those workers really are out of the retirement system in any meaningful way. So it may mean that there's earnings available for some folks, but for a large percentage of older workers, it's just not an option. And even if they get into it, it doesn't give them the kind of safety net of protection that they need to help them with retirement.
Does anyone else have any thoughts on the promise or peril of the gig economy?
I think Seth touched on everything.
Okay. Right. Yeah, that's a pretty
So let me just ask one more question, which is that, you know, a lot of times when we talk about the potential for older workers, we separate it, and we did this on this panel, we separate it between white collar and blue collar, basically being a proxy for those who are able to work and those who aren't. Is this the right way to think about it? Should we think instead about people's wages at older ages relative to their mid-career wages? So, for example, take two white collar workers who can both work at, both have the capability of working older, but one whose wage profile spikes in their 40s and 50s, and another who has more constant wage profile. Should we treat those two workers differently, even though they both can work at older ages? You know, so for people who are, you know, in an occupation where you can expect to make a ton of money in your 40s or 50s, maybe early 60s, but can still plausibly work in their 70s and 80s, should we be talking to them differently than someone who has more constant wages across their lifespan? Well, so I'm sort of thinking in the context of the life cycle model. So life cycle model sort of gives you, sort of gives some guidance about how to spread out your work effort and your consumption over the course of your life. Is it different for someone who's making a ton of money in your 40s and 50s? Should that person be working 100 hours a week and retire at 65, you know, versus someone who has more constant wages across their life? Should we be giving different advice to these people?
I think the people that are making a ton of money don't need our advice. And I think that that's probably a really small percentage of the population, so I don't think that's an issue that we ought to worry too much about.
Okay.
But I think the issue of lifetime income and how that changes over time is an important issue, but I wouldn't phrase it the way you did. It's just a matter of, you know, does it matter if people bunch their hours of work to have higher income at particular points in their life? Yes. And that's an individual choice in many cases. And how they phase out, or I guess I would have a slight argument with Alicia. It's always a problem if you do that because she's so good with her retorts. But I like phased retirement. And I think it is an excellent program in lots of cases, in part because she was putting it in the context of companies hiring workers. That's not where phased retirement is. That's just a part-time job. Phased retirement is when you're on a career job and you're thinking about how are you going to exit. And if you believe what employees say, a lot of them say they would like to have reduced work hours. And for whatever reason, the company's not let them. So what do? They go to some other job that will give them reduced hours. Wouldn't they be a lot better off if they could stay on their career job? And even if it's at a reduced wage, it's a, you know, they don't have to search, and they're still probably going to get much higher wages with that company than if they go to be a greeter at Walmart. So what is it about phased retirement? If you look at it, employees always, if you survey older workers, they're always saying something like that. We'd like to gradually reduce hours. If you go to companies, they always say, we don't want phased retirement. And some of the reasons they give you in response to surveys is that it's hard to manage. And employers seem to think that employees don't want it, even though the employees tell us that they do want it. So there's a lot going on there. And it also depends on the structure of the company a lot. So some of us here work at universities, and I don't know about Brookings. You probably just have the easy job all the time.
It's .edu.
But at a university, phased retirement is very popular.
Yeah.
And it works really nicely because you can divide up work pretty simply. You work one semester, you don't work the next semester. Half-time work for half-time pay. If you want to encourage people to go to phased retirement, you can say, give them 60% pay for 40% work or something like that, but it's in an environment where it works well. And a lot of universities have phased retirement programs, and a lot of people take phased retirement in universities. That does not seem to translate very well to a manufacturing sector in other areas. And you know, part of it may be that when you think about trying to reduce the person's compensation per hour as part of that, that becomes really difficult. Whether that's because of age discrimination or other things. But you know, one could imagine a phased retirement world that gets around a lot of the employer concerns, where not only do you go from full-time to half-time, you step down from being the supervisor and you're back to being a more common worker. And there's an associated reduction in wages for that.
And that would make the employer more likely to go to a program like that. And it would still leave the worker better off than going to be a greeter at Walmart.
The Japanese live longer than Americans. Mm-hmm. They retire shorter than Americans. Mm-hmm. They obviously work longer than Americans. And those Japanese workers in their 60s and 70s make less than they did when they were in their primary career job. They typically change jobs to lower wage jobs. That downward flexibility in wages and roles works in Japan.
If you look at the Japanese data, you find that the transition occurs in lots of different ways. So some big companies move people down to their subsidiaries, and they get a higher wage, lower wage relative to the career job, but a higher wage than they could get anywhere else. Then there are related companies and other things. So there's a nice progression in Japan. But if you look at the data, the Japanese labor force participation rate for people, men 65 and over, is about 35%. If you look in Europe, it's 7%. So there's something very different in the world in Japan, and the Japanese really want to work, and the Japanese really think stopping work affects their health. So that's a sort of another issue that we really haven't spent much on.
So just on this topic, that it's clear employers don't like...
We like to be able to answer. Which speaks to your question, actually.
Yeah.
So people don't like older workers. They don't. They avoid them. They try not to hire them. They have stereotypes in their minds. And so just one thing, Ben, is that either they're right and all older workers are dotty and nobody should hire them, and we should just forget this. Or if they're wrong, then we should try to educate them on the facts and somehow get the facts to them. I agree that maybe having the government speak to you might not be the best way to do that, but I don't know how else to do it. I mean, there are community groups and things like that, but they're also advocacy that you tend to disregard them. So that's one concern I have. I mean, if it's whatever the story, I think they're okay. I have to believe they're okay. But if they're okay, then we've got to convince other people that they're okay, and I don't know how to do it. In terms of this other nonsense about making them more needy than the rest of the kids, it just seems like a terrible idea. And Bob, you can argue with me, but you can't argue with Gusman and Steinmeier, because their point was it wouldn't increase work hours at all, which just seems like a very reasonable conclusion.
So we're going to give Steve 1 minute, and then we're going to open it up to questions.
Only 1 minute?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, if I can come back actually to Ben's actual question, which was for people with different kind of work trajectories during their careers. I think this maybe speaks a little bit to something like investment advisors probably talk about replacement rates. And for somebody who has a career where they start out, out of grad school, maybe they're not making much, and they have much elevated earnings later in life, if we're going to look at just like the last 5 years of earnings for replacement rate, and that's what old DB pensions used to be based on, that's a very different structure than somebody who starts out with basically about the wage level they're going to be throughout their career, maybe not live as long in terms of replacement rates. Now, maybe this is the plus of not being so much in the DB, because I guess Social Security, as you all know, looks at a wage-indexed average level of your earnings throughout your career, which tends to sort of even that out a little bit. But maybe even more so in the DC world, if we can encourage people at younger ages to actually start contributing and to contribute more and make it more attractive to them to do that. And I just, if I could, just the one little thing I'd like to go back to about the idea of allowing people not to have to pay any payroll taxes into the systems later, and that may be putting pressure on the younger people. And another possibility, just to throw this out there, and we don't make proposals, but just as a thought, a lot of people have talked about having the top 6% of the earnings people pay taxes on all of their earnings instead of limiting it to 132,000 or whatever we're at this point for this year. I mean, another possibility on that, sort of picking up on the EITC thing, is what if we had some tax paid on the level above 132, but then allowed that to be offset by having a somewhat lower tax on earnings up to some lower level, thereby for the people that were most worried about having the ability to save towards their retirement, give them a little bit lower tax rate, not just elders, but people of any age that have a tax burden, lower their tax burden, hoping that would encourage them to save more towards their eventual retirement. Just a thought.
So let's open it up. Let's start right here.
You've lost the microphone.
Thank you. I'm Dave Rabinowitz. I'm retired since 1989. And about 80 years ago, the U.S. went to a 40-hour work week. Since that time, productivity has increased by well over a factor of 5. And contrary to some reports, the rate of productivity increase is actually increasing. Productivity is increasing faster than it has been, and it's going to continue. And my question is, about 50 years ago, economists were predicting that by now people would be working 24 hours a week, which they could. And the question is, do we really want to be encouraging more jobs? I mean, do we really need them? Right now, most workers are not creating wealth. They're either distributing wealth or, in many cases, like lawyers, they're dissipating wealth. And do we really want to be encouraging more employment?
Seth, you want to take this?
Yeah, the lawyer crack really hurt my feelings. I'm the only lawyer right up here. Anyway, so John Maynard Keynes predicted in the 1930s that we would that people would be working, I think he said, 15 hours a week, and that would be only because they couldn't resist working, and that a combination of technology and what he called the interest rate, but really what he meant was a sort of investment return rates, was going to make work completely unnecessary. Kind of hasn't worked out that way, and I think the answer is we sort of have to deal with the world as we have it, not as the world as we expect it to be. I'm not sure I agree with your productivity numbers completely, but even if I agreed with them, even if I agreed with them, we do have a very large number of people, a very, very, very sizable percentage of people in the United States who simply don't have enough money to be able to retire. So given that fact, right, or they can retire, but they can't support themselves in a lifestyle that is even approaching the lifestyle that they have before they retire. So the question is, what do you do given that fact? So the approach that this forum takes, and I think it's the right one, is you have to sort of disaggregate the problem. So one piece of the problem is that people stop earning when they could continue earning. And how do you get them to be able to earn more so that they're taking less money out of retirement and they're accumulating more money for retirement? So my answer to your question is, yes, we should be encouraging some people to work more. Unless we are going to really dramatically transform the system that we have transformed it, but let me also say we've transformed it to favor more work, not to favor less work. The DB system supported, right, retirement at an earlier age and people being able to support themselves for the rest of their lives. They had a guaranteed, protected lifetime income that they could rely on, partially from Social Security, partially from a pension. That system is not entirely gone, but it is largely gone. And we've gone to a system instead where people are on their own, accumulating their own savings, figuring out how to decumulate those savings and how they're going to make it last for the rest of their lives. And so I would love to live in the world that you're positing, but I just don't think that we're there right now.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Nora Super. I'm with the Center for the Future of Aging at the Milken Institute. And this has been fascinating, and I love it. I just had so many questions, comments. I'll try not to make a speech, just a question mainly about Alicia and Abby's business case proposition. And I worked most of my career on the health side of the equation for aging people, and that hasn't been discussed as much. And I think what we're finding in the healthcare sector is, you know, it really is better for your health to work longer too. There's a lot of new evidence showing outcomes and spending associated with aging are better if you're engaged in your community, if you're doing things. So people who go off to work, even at a golf course, they get depressed, they get more chronic conditions, they have all these things that are associated with it. My question, I guess, a couple things on your elevator speech is, you know, to also look at, if you haven't already, Laura Carstensen's work at Stanford Center on Longevity that really talks about the benefits of older workers, you know, much further than them being a burden, actually, that they will take a mentor role, that they can better manage people. That, and then the UK's way ahead of us on some of this stuff because they have the mandatory retirement age. They've been looking, and they do the business case. They've done studies that show, like at McDonald's, having an older worker really increases your customer satisfaction rates. And I think we can do some of those correlations to see where older workers really benefit the bottom line of employers. On the consumer pitch, I would say we find much more people are concerned about brain health and getting dementia. That's their biggest fear. Bank of America did a whole client analysis, and that's what they feared the most. And so I think what we've been pitching more is what you do to keep your brain healthy so you don't end up in a nursing home, that you don't end up a burden to your children, is more powerful than money, actually, and that it encourages people to exercise, do things that lower their healthcare costs, but also encourage them to work, be stimulated, do other things. So, you know, I guess my question is, because I can't believe Alicia said no more research, I would really ask if you would start looking at some of the health outcome aspects of working longer, and those correlations I think could be really important to the literature.
So to our panel, what do you guys think about this correlation between health and work at older ages?
Correlation versus causation?
You tell me.
Which is the chicken, which is the egg? I mean, there's a serious, you know, typically...
Somebody at the center used data from the Netherlands, which they have every piece of information that you could possibly want. And there was a change in policy that encouraged people to stay later, and they could do a study on causation, and they looked at mortality. And mortality actually... People died later when they worked longer. So I liked all your comments.
But Alicia, wasn't that the ones who chose to work later, the ones who chose, that there was an ability to make a decision, they lived longer? I mean, people who are healthy and are likely to live longer tend to...
No, but let me just jump in to play tag team with Alicia for a second, because I think, I mean, it's extremely important that the vast majority of work, of research, which has pointed out that people who work longer tend to live longer, is very difficult to evaluate because this is simultaneously determined, right? It's just a correlation. Mm-hmm. I think you can count on just a couple of fingers the number of studies that really have something which is an honest-to-goodness experiment where different groups are exposed to a different set of retirement incentives. I was going to pick, it's all Nordic stuff because there's great data and things, but there's at least one case where I think it's in Sweden, and it's where school teachers, the change is that the normal retirement age for school teachers went from 62 to 64. And you have to deal with exactly what Steve is raising, which is you don't want to just look at people who voluntarily opted into something. So the comparison is between, you know, Alicia was a school teacher. She was 2 years older than I am, and she therefore faced a retirement age of 62. I'm 2 years, you know, behind, and my retirement age was 64. And what all you do is you look at what was the longevity experience of people who were in one cohort versus the next. You don't look at whether they chose to work or not. You just say the retirement age that they faced was different. They could have done whatever they did. And you just say what fraction of them were alive at age 70. And what you discover is the ones for whom the retirement age was 2 years higher, a higher fraction were still alive when they got to age 70. So, I mean, that's the one study, when I alluded this morning to this, some tantalizing evidence, that's the study I was thinking of. There are a couple of others that are in the same spirit, but this is a really hard problem to crack because of the simultaneous determination. Yeah. But the good news is that there is the beginning of evidence which is doing it, and it does suggest, just as you suggest, you indicated, that there may be some protective effects of working longer. Yeah.
I just want to ask two more questions. I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I try to. Let's start go with Pete in the back, and then we'll go Josh, and then you can finish with a question. You'll take the third question. So Pete, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah. So this is for Bob and John, and I was one of the people that didn't raise my hand when you asked, but a while back I thought a really good proposal would be to allow partial claiming of Social Security. And the reasoning I had was very low income people may be resource constrained and they may need a little more resources than they currently have, but we only give them a 0-1. And so why don't we allow them to partially claim, but let the other benefits go. Then what I realized is we already have that policy, that essentially The earnings test allows people to partially claim. That is, if I worked it out perfectly, I could get half my benefits and have delayed credits for half the years I've been working after I claimed, and then I have it. So the question is, have you thought about linking the removal of the earnings test with a proposal for partial claiming? And the comment is, I'd raise my hand if you did that.
No is the answer to have we thought about it. If you take benefits now, that means you're going to have fewer in the future. So I guess it depends on how much you think the trade-off between low income today versus lower income when you're 75 would be part of the issue. But
let me just say, our beef with the earnings test, you obviously understand it really well. And what you say is exactly right. Our beef with it is mass confusion. People don't understand that. They think it's a tax, and they behave accordingly. If everybody understood it, we wouldn't necessarily be against it, because we would have exactly your point of view. But it seems like it's too complex for people to really figure out. It's been around since 1935, and they haven't figured it out yet.
Could I just add that, I mean, could all economists agree from this day forward to stop using the word tax about the earnings test? I will admit, at Social Security has not done all it could, all it should, about really educating people about this. So, you know, we've done PSAs and stuff, but people continue to think of it as being a tax. It's money that's lost forever. And in fact, given the nature of the reduction factors in delayed retirement credits, if you believe anything about the current interest rates and longevity rates, it's a heck of a deal. I mean, it's a great deal. It's a forced savings plan to buy more of a CPI-indexed life annuity. Where else are you going to get that? So, I mean, if it were better understood, and if we could all agree, stop calling it a tax. Because part of the reason people are hearing it, they hear it in the popular press. They hear people, like many in this room, quoted as saying, it's a tax. Well, so the press doesn't understand it as well as they should, and maybe we could correct that. Maybe you all could correct that.
So you think people take their Social Security advice from economists?
Well, I think a lot of people in the press actually listen to economists and reiterate some of what they say. Well, maybe they should listen to lawyers.
Let's go here and then there in the back. Josh.
Josh Gottbaum, Brookings. Seth mentioned explicitly, Alicia implicitly, that there is the question of unequal bargaining power between employees and employers. And I realize, Bob and John, that in one sense, you don't care all that much if the incentive gets translated as higher wages to older workers, or whether it gets taken by the employer who then uses discrimination in favor of older workers to pick up the rents, in effect. But my question is, in practice, is there anything that you can do or see to keep your proposal, which I think is wonderful, from becoming an explicit incentive to, in effect, keep the rents and essentially have discrimination in favor of older employees rather than younger, because the demand for labor is inelastic?
Well, certainly one could just forget the employer part of the proposal and just say eliminate the employee tax. That's one thing. And it depends in part on whether or not you think employers would, in fact, increase demand for the workers if they had the 100%, if they bore the entire part of the employer tax, in which case that would still be presumably good for older workers if it increased the demand for older workers. If that was the holdup in adopting the policy, one could say, well, let's just do the employee part. And in this city, the people that vote on these things, for some reason, they believe the employer bears 100% of the tax anyway. And that's how they behaved over 75 years or 80 years or whatever.
In the back, please.
The business case. If the plus 50 segment spends about $7 trillion a year and we account for over 50% of the spend in some huge categories like trucks and cars and apparel. If I'm not working, I can take my coffee in a thermos. I can keep my 8-year-old Chevy. I can shop in my closet. Why isn't the business case that part of it? This huge amount of money, we're huge drivers in the economy. I never hear that as part of the business case.
So I've heard that point in terms of why companies should be strategizing and how they build their market for older workers and their products for older workers. But I really haven't heard it in the terms you're framing of telling employers, keep, make sure I'm understanding this, to tell employers that they should keep older workers so that they can continue consuming.
That is part of the case.
We should be in the workplace, not as a favor. It's not a favor. We directly impact their bottom line as millions of us are pushed out of the workplace or have much lower incomes. Mm-hmm. And I never, the business case is always framed like, please hire us. We really are, you know, can learn technology. We are a major part of their bottom line. And that point has to be made as well, I think.
Jim, you started off talking about the macro side.
Let me just say, I mean, I think the point for the macro economy, mm-hmm, that on a more active labor market presence for older workers would have some pro effects on the size of the economy, on aggregate demand, is all well taken. But I think from the standpoint of the business case, you have to convince a particular firm that they want to hire this particular worker. So I may think it's all fine for Alicia to hire these workers and they can buy my goods.
But if
I don't think that they are producing value for my firm equal to what I have to pay them, I'm going to pass on hiring them, just sell to them. So I think the case is, when you get down to the microeconomics of the firm, you have to make the case that it is the lower absenteeism, it is the more accurate production of whatever they're supposed to do. It's their transmission of knowledge, it's their mentoring. Those are the things which actually raise the value of the marginal product of these workers within the firm. And that's ultimately where you have to convince a manager that they're going to decide this is a good thing to do. So I think you have to distinguish two pieces. Yeah.
Okay, so we've been here for 3 hours. We haven't even given you guys a break. It's been a terrific session. There's no better way to end than with a comment from Jim Paterba. So thank you so much for being part of this panel. I really appreciate it.